Hello and welcome to Not About the Weather, episode number 30. This is our end of the year special for 2018. Yeah, here we go. 2018. We've said it many times. It's a long year and we want to hear from what you guys felt of this year as well. We love getting into your feedback. Our contact information is at NATW Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Gmail. Our website is notaboutheweatherpodcast.com. And you can also follow our Tumblr account and send us an ask. And we have a hub for our podcasts called NATW Podcast singular.com. If you wanted to know what our podcast is and it's your first time tuning in, it is the greatest podcast about everything and nothing. We skip the small talk and get into the nitty-gritty, hence skipping the weather, though that's often something we call a fun fact. I'm your host, Mitch, and I'm joined by Brittany and Natalie. All right, Natalie, we'll start off with you. How are you doing today? Anything special going on?
No, not really. It's very hot.
Yeah, you were saying. Yeeks. Do you know how it is in Fahrenheit for us non-Celsius people?
Yeah, it's, I mean, Australian Christmas, you know, that's something that we, I feel like I talk about that every year, but yeah, it is higher than, it's going to be 86 and higher, probably more like up to, say, 95, 98, 100, you know, like in, depending on what part of the city you're in.
Wow, yeah. And it's probably pretty humid, I can imagine, near Sydney.
So it's sometimes it comes, yeah, so it can have both. So
yeah,
worst of both worlds, really.
It's literally like Christmas in July for my mind. It's so strange. I don't know. I would ever feel like it was authentic. It reminds me of like the Full House episodes where they have to like spray the snow on the windows to feel like they're actually having Christmas in San Francisco.
What?
That's like
that's something that happened.
It's like probably a thing people do in California all the time, or hot places, I assume. But yeah, that was like, I remember that being a thing. Like Danny Tanner was like spraying the windows with fake snow so that they could feel more authentically like they were in Christmas. All right, Britt, how are you doing tonight?
You know, fantastic. Celebrated my fifth Christmas today with another part of the family. It does not end. Well, it's hard to see everyone in one day, especially when you have divorced parents. So you have to split family time around. So I got to see another subsection of my family today to exchange Christmas gifts. But this is the tradition with that part of my family. We usually get together the weekend in between Christmas and New Year's to celebrate. So I had a huge family party most of the day today. And then I think I only have one more small Christmas thing tomorrow morning, and then I'm done, I think. I hope. Not that I hope. I love Christmas. I wish it would last forever, but it's very chaotic, the actual celebrating of it. I love the buildup and the shopping and getting everything together, but then, you know, by the fifth time you're eating cookies again and heavy food, my body is like, what is a salad? I don't remember. So I'm looking forward to not having plans New Year's Eve and New Year's Day and just sitting in my apartment detoxing and like just chilling out.
You're in an apartment that you said you've moved recently, and you said something on Instagram stories that I don't really understand, Instagram stories, that I think was a joke about where you were living that I didn't understand because I don't know American sitcoms, but something about like some town. So where do you live and what was the joke? I mean, you don't have to say where.
Yeah. Was this
something about
today or yesterday?
No, not today, like before Christmas.
Before Christmas? Oh, I compared my town to a very old show. Yes. Okay. So.
Okay. You're picking up what I'm putting down.
I'm picking up. What you're putting down. Okay. So, I compared my town to Mayberry from the Andy Griffith Show, which is like, so the Andy Griffith Show was like a show, like it was black and white when it was on TV. It was a very old show, and Mayberry is what people refer to as like the, when they're talking about like the perfect town.
Twee little town.
Yes, like, yeah. Exactly. Like, where everybody knows each other's name, and, like, the police officer is, well, Andy Griffith played the police officer, but it's sort of like, oh, how you doing, buddy? Like, you know, it's just, like, hometown USA, where, like, my town literally had three Christmas tree lightings in case you couldn't make one. So,
that's so cute!
Yeah, so, like, that's basically where I live, and the only reason I asked if you were talking about last night's Instagram story was because I was reading.
I didn't see that yet.
Yes, I was reading the town bulletin last night as I was sitting on my couch after my friends left. And one of the activities that my town offers is they have a doggy hour at the library where children of any age can read to the therapy dog.
Does the therapy dog need reading too? That's great. I didn't know that was a thing.
Can you imagine the visual reading to the dog?
Yeah, it's a thing that sometimes they do with dogs and kittens at shelters and stuff. Like, because it's more that children need help reading aloud, like practicing aloud. And the dogs don't know what they're saying. Animals just like being talked to and being socialized. So it's like they do it. Shelters often do it as a partnership, like where the kids will come in and sit in the cat cage and read to the kittens, and it helps the kittens be socialized and the cats and the children have someone to read aloud to.
This town continues to be perfect. And I took my two college friends came to visit me yesterday, and we were walking around, and every like little shop, and like it's in a historic district. Like, I live across the street from where Thomas Paine grew up and like lived for a while.
What?
And yeah, it's crazy.
So how are you living? So when did you, because you moved pretty recently?
Yeah, I moved in the beginning of November, so about 2 months ago.
And into like with your family or just by yourself?
No, just myself.
Okay. And you live alone in this small town?
Yes.
That's interesting. Interesting. But you haven't, like, changed jobs or anything. You're still in the area.
Yeah. I moved closer, actually, to my job.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
But it is very, very twee, as you say, and very cute. And all the shops are, like, local businesses, and they've been there forever. And it's a very historic town. So it's really cool. I like it a lot.
Well, Brett, that sounds so precious, and I guess the generic thing I would say is sounds like a Stars Hollow kind of place. I'm sure you have your own lazy, crazy, hazy days of summer there.
Very Stars Hollow. They have, anything you can think of. And right now, so, like, I live really close to Trenton and right, like, maybe a 15-minute drive from where Washington crossed the Delaware. And so right now he crossed the Delaware on Christmas Eve. So like it's been a big historic push for the area because it's like a huge deal to the town. They have like Patriot Week and like, you know, all the historic like tours are going on and like, oh, come walk like around like the battle sites. And like the Delaware River had like huge like celebrations and reenactors were everywhere. And they had like a pub crawl and it's really cute, though. I do really like the history part of it.
That is precious. I love that kind of stuff. For real. It's kind of what makes the world still tick in a way. I think that you can go into a lot of negative spins with current events, but then when you go back to the small town vibe, you understand just how people are meant to live if they can. It's in a place where you can feel safe and happy and cozy. You can drink your hot cocoa and walk around the flurrying town square, I guess.
Yeah, it's really, I really like it. It is very relaxing too. Instead of like, you know, I'm still used to like, you know, having to get in my car to go everywhere, but now I can like walk downstairs and go get a sandwich or I can, you know, I like being able to walk places, but I don't like huge cities. So, like, I can go to New York 100 times a year, but it's so much all the time that I like to, like, get in and get out sort of deal.
Oh, yeah. The energy there is exhausting. The feeling like, alone of being there.
But one thing I do have to get used to, though, is that, like, everyone is super, super nice. And I grew up in a very small, like, 1 square mile town where everyone knew each other. But I've been so detached for that for so long that now I have to be like, oh, people do want to say hello to you when you're walking on the street and not like New York where I'm like, get out of my way. I'm walking 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
People are like, hello, how are you? And I'm like, oh, you are being actually genuinely nice.
Where you actually wave to the police officers as opposed to avoiding their eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel that. Today I did that too. I was like, you gotta wave at all of them. You probably know them. I'm in a small town too, so a lot of what you're saying is tracking very well in my brain. Actually, you know, I think what's going to track for Brittany and Natalie is something we were talking about before. I had to fill you in, Britt. So I did just go to New York City following your conversation there. It was so overwhelming. It was a lot.
But
it was
didn't you post like 3 a.m. on Twitter though and from Times Square?
Well, I was already home. I just was like, oh, I haven't tweeted in a couple of days. So I looked on my pictures and I was like, oh, I should just do that from today. Cause I didn't get home till 2. The show was at 7. I was seeing Anastasia.
Oh.
And I had a great time walking all around. You can't see enough. It's just amazing. Like my camera was out like a tourist the whole time. Like billboards, all these awesome sculptures. Let's look at these tourists doing things. I was on screen for a little bit because they had one of those cameras. That's always fun. But it came to the point where I got to the show, and even though in the Anastasia playbill there was not a replacement slip for the actors, we were with like the fourth, not even like understudies, but like swings for both the roles of Anastasia and Dimitri, the leads. And it was so hard to get through. The entire audience was reacting as they were trying their very best to act through all of what needs to be done in the musical. They had like no energy left. You could tell they had to like rush through these roles and try and figure it out. It was sad. It was such a disappointment. I've never had a Broadway experience like this before. I don't think I ever will again. It was such a rare experience that would have happened. But, I mean, I'm going to assume that the leads were probably spending time with their families or whatnot. I don't know. Cody Simpson was supposed to be one of the leads. He was apparently a pop star that I've kind of barely heard of.
I think it doesn't even start until January, though.
No, he was. I mean, I'm seeing advertisements still that he's meant to be in it starting December 17th until January. So, I mean, you're aware then of the stunt casting and then of the show, I assume then, Britt.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that. Well, right now, so like the week before, like I think it's a few days before Christmas through Christmas and New Year's, they also add shows. So, like they're doing.
Like 2 shows every day?
Yeah,
they were.
Like 2 shows Sunday, 2 shows Saturday, sometimes 2 shows Friday, and then the regular 2 shows Wednesday on top of the 1 show Thursday, whatever. But yeah, so like they probably are swinging out a lot. I think that the only reason I know this is because I follow her on Instagram. I feel like she was home. She just got engaged.
Christy something or another.
Yeah. But she might be off for the holidays.
Which they deserve. Like, it just felt unplanned. None of it felt like it was meant to be.
Yeah.
It was sad because, like, I paid $200 for my ticket, and I was in the mezzanine. And I was like, okay, I'm going to just love this. I have my monocle and everything. And, like, literally looking in on the actors, I could just see that their expression was dead. They weren't even acting anymore. They were just going through the motions. It was sad. It was so, I just felt for them because I was like, I don't think this is of your doing. I feel like you were shoved into doing this last minute. That's the only other way I could have presented it to my mind, because if not, I couldn't say they're bad actors. I don't think they are. They're on Broadway. They've earned their way onto there. But there were moments where they'd miss cues. There were moments where their voices would just run flat, where they couldn't hit the notes, where they just couldn't really have the whole of the jazz hands. They just were just so done. But the ensemble was outstanding. That's where I was putting 2 and 2 together to say, okay, I think that this is just the leads being shoved in, because the ensemble were all like showstoppers, especially like the tertiary characters and any of the secondaries. They were just, oh my God, amazing. And the staging was amazing. The whole show was presented in such a spectacular fashion. But then when you're bogged down by the leads, you're like, what do I do here? Like, did I enjoy my experience, or is it just something I suffered through and I can hope to never have again? And I don't know. It feels weird talking about it because they're like real life people that you saw in real life as opposed to like TV. So critiquing the performance always feels strange to me whenever I see any live play. But I guess it's just the way it was. Cause like I said, the whole audience was reacting. Like, we were all kind of looking around at each other when something amiss would happen. And that's a bad scenario because everybody feels awkward about it. We're like, oh no, this is so expensive and it's just not going well. But I'll always have the soundtrack to supplement my experience, I suppose.
Yeah, Cody Simpson is in the Virgin Islands right now.
Oh, according to his Instagram. I don't know how you would use Dimitri. Pop stars coming into Broadway is always a mix.
Some are good, but I don't know about that.
I don't know. I saw Corbin Bleu in the Heights, actually, as the lead. And he did great, actually. I was really impressed.
I think he was a theater actor, though. Anyway.
I would believe that, yeah. So it's
He's been in a few things. I think he's less of a stunt casting and more of someone who just does a lot of mediums.
Yeah, no, I would say so, too. Kind of like Darren Criss would have been for How to Succeed.
Yeah, Corbin Bleu also did Godspell, and he did a few things, I think. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's our Broadway segment for today, I guess, because we know who's going to do that. This is not about the weather. And if it's not about the weather, it's about Broadway with the three of us on here. But now to get into our main segment of the show, we're going to do a hype and a gripe slash an obsession to share and a grievance to air. Meaning we're going to be doing our ultimate hype and our ultimate gripe of 2018 each. So this means that we're going to be basically doing the best thing that's happened to us this year and the worst thing that's happened to us this year. This could be an experience, more personal, worldwide, media-wise. We're going to kind of sprinkle in the type of hype and gripe that we're going to have. But we do always have this choice of doing hyper gripe first. I feel like we lean toward doing great first so we can end on a better note. Does that sound right?
Sometimes, yeah.
We've been doing that.
I think we'll do that. Okay. Let's go with gripes. I'm going to go in order here. All right, Britt, so we're going to start with your gripe at the top of the show.
All right, so I wanted to pick 900 things, so I threw them all in a bucket. And my gripe for 2018 was that it was not a great year for me to be a fan of the things that I wanted to watch on TV. A, because they were either just not airing in 2018, looking at you, American Gods.
Mm-hmm.
B, had bad press around them, also looking at you again, American Gods. Also adding in the cancellation of Shadowhunters and Freeform's complete dismissal of the series. And then C, just there were, you know, there were shows that aired in like January. And when something airs in January in the year 2018, it feels like it aired 200 years ago, and I didn't have any new shows on this year, which really kind of bummed me out. I felt very disconnected from television shows because there was nothing really on Netflix that I was really into. Everything was like fleeting, so there was nothing new to keep me entertained week to week. And I realized this year that I like having shows week to week. I do not like a binging model. I'm over it. I like my weekly shows. I've reverted back to my early 2000 self where I like to come home every day and know even if I can't watch it live, there is something on every week that's new that I can tune into. So when Star Trek premiered, you know, it was new every week and it was great. And I had a great time. I loved writing about it. And I think that's something else that I really missed in 2018 was having something to consistently write about. So Shadowhunters was on this year. It was supposed to be on all year. So I had the first half of 2018 writing about Shadowhunters week by week. There was a new episode every week. There was a teaser for the next week. There was a lot of just that anticipation of like, what's going to happen? What am I going to write about? There was theory speculation, but that was it. There was one show. I got that for one show this entire year. And so I just like wasn't looking at a show that I wanted to binge or a new series where I'm like, oh, I have to watch the whole thing before I can write about it. This isn't a sustainable model for me because writing about stuff like week to week, it's like, oh, it's already old news if I didn't have the 12 hours to sit down and write about
it. Like I think that there's something there that needs to kind of, like, I think that in the media, it needs to be decided that either it's okay to write kind of like evergreen pieces about a binge show, like at any point, not just when it comes out, or it needs to be totally eliminated and that it's just useless to write about. Like, it's one or the other, you know? Like, it's got to be like, oh, I just watched, you know, all of this. I finally got the time and here are my thoughts about it. At any point, that needs to be acceptable, or we need to, like, stop writing about it altogether because it's completely useless, you know?
Yeah, and it's hard to, like, feel like you have anything to contribute to the conversation if you waited even 3 days to watch it, you know? Like, Jesus. Yeah, it's, I don't
think that hard in about something in 3 days. I think part of the week-to-week model is, like, that reflection period or, like, you know, like Supernatural, for example, obviously is week-to-week, thank God. And, like, you know, something will air and I'll spend a couple of days, you know, thinking about what about the episode stood out to me and whether it's something that I want to tie back to, you know, like, you know, 10 other episodes that I thought, you know, related to something in this one or about whether it was specifically something about the plot or whatever, you know, like that, you know, time to actually study one episode at a time.
Yeah. And one of the other things too, like, so I complained about doing this all the time, but I would write about Scandal week to week. And I realized when Scandal ended, I missed it so much because you know what it was? It was like, it was that thing every Thursday at 9 o'clock that I was watching and it was a hot mess and it was so good.
You liked the hot mess.
I liked getting mad at it, but I liked having that thing every week where you're like, How messy is it going to be?
Yeah,
it was, you know, inconsequential messy. Like, they're not trying to make a huge statement with, like, things, and it's fun, and, you know, it is played for what it is. But now everything is like, am I sitting down to watch a comedy, or am I sitting down to watch a comedy that's actually going to, like, devastate me? I feel like there's so much around, like, bigger shows that are coming out, which is great. So much great television is being made. But 2018, for some reason, like, without having my set weekly shows, by the end of this year, I was just like, that's why, honestly, I think that's why I watched Hallmark movies from October until literally this morning.
Well, because it's like not fun and not relaxed. Yeah,
I'm not relaxed watching, sitting down to watch anything. So I've been like rewatching Frasier and Hallmark movies. Those have been my two go-tos. Like, I watched Will and Grace every week and I watched Superstore every week, but those are half hour sitcoms and they made me the happiest. Like I felt myself putting so much pressure on those two shows by the end of the year because like that was it.
I need you to be okay. Yeah,
I need you to be good and I need you to give me exactly what I want.
And yeah, I was going to ask you about Will and Grace because that seems like it's the only glue that I knew of. And of course, I still need to learn more about Superstore. We'll get to that idea of me not knowing about Superstore in a bit, trust me. But in general, I understand how you feel because it's so stressful to binge. I just let it happen when it's going to happen. At this point, I don't plan my House of Cards watch right now. I'm just like, okay, cool. It's out. Like, it fits into this giant backlog, as I often reference. We'll get to it later. It's not on TV, so I guess I don't have to rush to it.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, too. It's like, do I have to make a plan to watch these shows? But when I go to sit down to be like, oh, let me start something, it's so overwhelming with the amount of stuff that I have not watched that it's like, I don't even know where to begin, which leads me to the second half of my 2018 gripe TV-related and movie-related, to be completely honest. I actually saw more movies this year because they were, like, less pressure than watching any TV. But I hate award shows. I'm so over award shows. I was over them a couple of years ago, mainly because the red carpets would make me angry. And, like, there were certain shows that I watched and they would get nominated, but like I didn't feel any investment because there are 457 new scripted dramas on this year. Like, not dramas, but like I think it's 495 or something ridiculous.
Really?
To the FX report this year.
Scripted shows.
Yeah, new scripted shows. Like there are that many shows on. So like,
and that's just new. Like that's not counting the already running.
No, that's all shows.
Does that count like streamers?
Yeah. So it's like nothing I watch regularly, so like Elementary, for example, is not going to be nominated, which is fine, but there's no way for shows that are, for all shows to be awarded anything anymore. So it's sort of like, yes, Killing Eve is a fantastic show. It should be nominated for all the Emmys. Sandra Oh should win every award. But at the same time, it's like, okay, but what about the 300 other shows I watched? Like, I feel bad for like people who are making like shows that just aren't even making a blip of the radar. And there's just so much going on that I think it's the award show structure needs to accommodate it. And it's not, because there's a comedy category, but like Big Bang Theory won the comedy category for what, like 11 years in a row, it feels like. And then all of a sudden now all the comedy lines are blurred. So like a show that is traditionally like, won by like a show Maisel like the Big Bang Theory.
What's comedy, like Schitt's Creek, comedy or drama, you know, like what is storytelling? And then like there's some that have been put in really weird, like a show that's actually like Golden Globes or something, like the musical or comedy. And then this year there's like something that's like an actual musical show that's not in musical or comedy, it's in drama. And I'm like, because it's a dramatic show, and I'm like, but it's a musical and there's a musical category.
Yeah, nothing like
what's happening?
Also, like the whole hosting drama, like there's just so much around award shows that just like make me angry that like I haven't sat down to watch an award show in I don't think I watched one in 2018. I think I like maybe watched some of the
Emmys or no.
No. I didn't watch any of it. I don't care. Like, it's not even like I am happy for the actors, actresses, directors, writers, everyone getting nominated. I watched Darren Criss's speech the next morning after it. I didn't watch the actual award show. But, like, I'm happy for them, but for some reason this year, I just cannot be bothered with them.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of another problem, as you're saying, categories. Horror tends to be one that's always snubbed, and Get Out was in the comedy category, the most problematic category, it seems, because musicals do get grouped into that, which they could almost get their own with movies as well. It's frustrating.
Yeah, look, I mean, there's definitely those lines are blurred. I mean, the idea of, you know, various genre shows never being considered like that kind of high, you know, high caliber award show level television. That's like an age old problem. And oh God, I wish I could find it. If anyone ever comes across this article again, please link it to me. I once read an article a few years ago and it was like 50 showrunners of genre shows like recommend. Like they kind of, they're confronted with this problem of like, you know, we all know that this isn't ever going to be like award-winning television because of the genre curse, you know. But here are the episodes either of my show or of like another genre show that I think like if it was a fair playing field, like if people were actually looking at all kinds of genres for the quality of the storytelling or the acting or the directing or whatever, here's what I think should be nominated. So it was like 50 different showrunners from genre shows, all kind of basically nominating, you know, either their favorite piece of theirs or another show's. And it was amazing. And I've never found it again. I read it once and I've Googled like so many combinations, never found it again. But that's a really common, like, and if you work in genre television in any way, like, you know, procedurals or, you know, certainly sci-fi and fantasy, it's just not ever, except apparently Game of Thrones, that can win awards, which is totally sci-fi and fantasy, but that's on HBO. So, like, it's just all these weird rules about, like a kind of, like, a glass ceiling that various genres or various, you know, kind of calibers, various shows hit, and it's not fair, and that's an age-old problem. But you are so right, Brittany, about even the stuff that is getting nominated, the lines being so blurred now because no one seems to know what to do with these categories. And I'm kind of wondering, I'm at the point of wondering whether even gender categories are ever going to be eliminated. Like, you know, best best male performance, best female performance. I understand that's a way to give like more people awards, but what if it was like, should it be more exclusive in pitting, you know, like whoever, like, you know, Sandra Oh against Peter Dinklage or whatever, like, or should it be like, should it just be like the best of the best, or should it be like more categories, or like, how would you change award shows, Brittany, if you wanted to like them?
I don't think that I would. Ideally, like, yes, it would be great if we could get to a part where it was just like best actor and it was whoever was in the category was in the category. But with the way the internet and the world works, if Pete, like, for example, let's say Peter Dinklage did give the best performance of his entire career in Game of Thrones, and you have Sandra Oh for Killing Eve, if Peter Dinklage won, it would be an uproar. Because a male won over a female, and if a male That's won true. 2 years in a row,
yeah,
like, forget it. We would never get anywhere. Either way, no one's going to be happy. But if I could change award shows, honestly, I don't know what I would do, because I have been thinking about this, because I think that I would start with the categories. I would have to say that, like, if I spent 95% of my time crying watching your show, it's not a comedy. And if I spent, like, you know, I think that there should be a streaming category now, because there's too many things going on where, like, a CBS or, like, even, like, a CW does not have the budget of HBO or Amazon Prime or Netflix. Just, it's not there.
Yeah.
And I think that there should also be more, like, even if this is, like, even if this comes down to, like, a creative arts type Emmy where, like, they don't broadcast it, but there's just something else, like, best, like, long show that's been on the air for over 10 years category. You know what I mean? Like, there are some shows that have been on forever.
Grey's Anatomy, Supernatural.
Yeah, Grey's Anatomy, Supernatural. Those performances are not being looked at anymore. Like, they're just not.
Yeah.
And I think that, especially with Supernatural, as I've heard Natalie talk about and write about, it's taken a turn and people don't know about that because they either stopped watching it 5 years, like, 5, 6, 7 years ago. I think that there should be, like, a re-recognition of shows, but I don't know how to get that into a 3-hour program. I also believe that only people with theater backgrounds should be hosts. People with theater backgrounds or stand-up comics who are not good. In trouble should be hosts, because I love a good musical number. You're never going to go wrong with that. I think James Corden should host everything just across the board. But, you know, like, I want so much for award shows to be better, but also I don't see it getting better. It's the same thing every year, and I don't even think people like going to them. You know, like, I feel zero enthusiasm from both sides. Like, the people who are there and the people watching, no one's happy.
I feel like it used to be more exciting, and I know a couple of people who do seat filling at a few. Like, I've seen kind of a little bit of what that life is like, but I feel like people enjoy the Golden Globes because you get to eat and drink at dinner, rather than sitting in a theater. But I do feel like that the hype has gone away.
Yeah, and I feel like people just, they're excited when they win, but I do, for some reason, and I don't think that this is true. I really think that this is me projecting this on the winners and the actors and stuff. I feel so disconnected from them. Even if it's a show that I watched and liked, I don't even, like, as I'm watching a speech or someone win, I'm like, I don't even have the ability to be like, eh, good for them. Like, I don't, I just, like, I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. Like, thank I'm not, yeah, I'm not in, like, I don't care what people are going to say up there. Like, I'm just so disconnected from award shows, and I don't know what it'll take for me to get back into it. But that being said, like my comment earlier, at least once a year, if not multiple times, I will watch Neil Patrick Harris's opening to the Tonys. I will watch Jimmy Fallon's opening to the Emmys.
Is the Tonys different, by the way?
Or the Tonys. Oh, the Tonys. I will watch. The Tonys are the Tonys. They're a completely different category.
Yeah, yeah.
They got it figured out. There's no way they can mess it up. Yeah. Everyone's happy to be there.
Yeah.
I will watch Neil Patrick Harris's opening to the Tonys. I will watch. What did James Corden? I watched the carpool karaoke opening of, was it the Tonys? There's one where he does carpool karaoke. I don't know if it was the Tonys or the Emmys or the Globes. But then also I watched recently Jimmy Fallon's opening of the Emmys with the Glee cast, or they have to form a Glee club to get tickets to the Emmys. And
I don't remember this.
I don't know this.
What, you don't know this? They get John Hamm and Tina Fey. It was like when 30 Rock was like huge.
Oh God.
And he has to like recruit people for the Glee Club. And
oh, maybe I do. I don't know.
It's very good. It's very good. They sing a Bruce Springsteen song. They sing Born to Run. Tim Gunn's in it. It's fantastic.
Why? So weird.
Betty White. John Hamm is teaching Betty White how to dance. It's amazing. It has something for everyone. There are slushies. It brings back a lot of like bad
slushies.
Cause like Jane Lynch is Coach Sue. It's great. But yeah, I don't like Jimmy Fallon anymore, but yeah. I do love that opening. Like it's just something like that. Like that was when I was excited about watching it. And it wasn't just because Glee was nominated. Like I was excited when Will and Grace was nominated, of course, but those casts were having fun on the carpet and they were, you know, there were these little shows on NBC that were being nominated because the pool wasn't so big. So I feel like these people, the people who are coming from the HBO shows, from the Hulu shows, like, you know, Handmaid's Tale is going to sweep, but like those people are there and they're like, it's more of an Oscars. I always hated the Oscars, but it's more the other, like all TV is becoming so prestigious, which is great. Like I'm happy with the content that's being created, but everything is so I'm creating the Handmaid's Tale and changing television forever, as opposed to like, I'm on Will and Grace and this is the comedy of the year. I'm up against Desperate Housewives over here. Like, you know, it's like no one is having fun, I feel like, but they're making great television. So who am I to say that they can't have that attitude?
Yeah, we're in an embarrassment of riches since like the internet became the streaming service forever, and we're not going to stop. We're only going to get more mediums. Like Disney Plus is coming. Be prepared. We're gonna dig in deep too.
And where would
a
that
lot of TV like in the future?
Like that. Like if there was ever to be a new Marvel show on Disney Plus, like is that going to get nominated? The Marvel shows on Netflix aren't. So you know, it's like. It's how do you accommodate all the greatness that's being made without isolating viewers who are like my parents, for example, they'll watch every single award show that's on. They have no idea who anyone is because they don't have streaming. Like they have no idea what this, they're like, oh, I heard of that. Is that on the Netflix? And I'm like, no, it's on
Netflix.
The Netflix. And I'm like, no, it's on Hulu or no, it's on Amazon. And it's like,
yeah,
I can watch that on my Amazon. And I'm like, yeah, it's not even worth like.
Maybe there should be a new awards show. Maybe streamers should be banned from like the streamy Emmys and then the network Emmys. Like,
yeah, I mean, that's like, the other thing that it's like, how many Emmys do you have?
I think there needs to be a split, like literally a part one for vanilla television and then a part two for streaming.
But then that creates the like, divide between like what's more legitimate, like what's, say they're both good, but yeah, but what's the like second prize and what's the real?
Yeah. So like, does that even really help though? Because then HBO is still against like CBS and ABC and then, you know, like AMC, like Better Call Saul, you know, like those,
yeah,
they're still there and they're as good as Handmaid's Tale and anything on Netflix. So like you really can't, that's why I'm saying like, I don't have a solution,
it's impossible.
But I'm happy to gripe about it along with the fact that nothing really thrilling happened in terms of TV this year for me. Like, and if it did, it happened so early in the year that by the end of this year, I was just so disconnected from wanting to tap back into TV that, and then I think I foresee a problem, or again, like Mitch, you called it an embarrassment of riches coming. I have like all of my shows are premiering January, February, March. So like, am I going to be done by April again? Like what, where does that leave me? Like I'm going to have the same problem because everything is so limited now. Like when Grey's, if I feel like I have to get back into Grey's Anatomy. So I have 22 episodes a year of something. Like, I don't
think you need to do that.
No, I don't definitely don't need to do that. But, you know,
I mean, like, you can if you want, but you
know. It's these limited, like if you don't have a show that's running weekly for every season of the year, then like by the end of April, I'm done.
Yeah, like
all my shows. That's Star Trek. That's the end of Shadowhunters and American Gods will be done. So like,
and I forgot Star Trek was even going on amongst like the world. It's crazy.
A lot of my favorites are also like, 12 episodes, like, you know, not full seasons. Okay. Like, so Good Place is about to finish. Like it's coming back for, you know, after January, but only for a couple of episodes. Schitt's Creek, January, and it'll be like 13 episodes. So again, like done by March. Call a Midwife, which is a BBC series that I follow week to week, which is, I love it. But again, it's going to premiere January and be finished by April. And yeah, Supernatural's 20 episodes, but it'll be finished by the end of the, you know, it'll be finished. And then I don't even, you know, we don't know how many more seasons or when it'll come back for, you know, for that, because that's a bit of a wild card. So there are a lot. Yeah, there's nothing that dependable, I guess, is what you can say.
Yeah.
There's something to be said about going back to a basic, if the show is done, then I'll watch it. But then that's back to binging, because then, you know, it's, you know, complete arc. For instance, I don't think I would watch Supernatural until it was all the way done. I tried to do that with Grey's Anatomy. I tried to just say, oh, they're going to probably cancel it soon. I'll start watching it. And they were in like season 7. They're still going on. I just stopped because I was like, I'll get to it when they're done. Just please end your show so I can easily. I prefer to binge in a way, Britt. I'm like yourself that you're saying, you know, you find that habit.
Well, the problem is, like, I'm having trouble. It's not so much like shows that are like I'm behind on. It shows that like I don't even want to start because by the time I get the time or like I feel like I'm like ready to start something, I'm like I feel like I can't do it because there's so, like when Killing Eve was having its huge moment, right? Like
I haven't seen it.
I was away and I didn't have time to watch it. And so like when I finally came back, it was right before the finale. I'm like, do I have to watch all of this before the finale? Because like, I feel like it's going to be irrelevant, but it was, it ended up not being irrelevant, but like, I finally did watch it, but it was, you know, a weekend where like, I finally just had nothing to do and I wasn't moving and I wasn't doing something else, but it was, by the time I finished it, I was like, I can't even, like, I don't even want to tweet about this because people are going to be like, oh, you sat on this. I can't believe you sat on it. I'm like, well, I did.
That's a nasty attitude, like, for people to be like gross about. And I'm still writing. I'm writing a big ode to Schitt's Creek up about the Christmas episode that aired, which really should have been released before Christmas, but Leo hurt herself and I did not have time to finish it. But it'll be good. It'll be evergreen. Don't worry about it. And it is in the fourth season and has taken a real like uptick this year.
Yeah, it has.
Like massively. And I'm trying to identify why, but I'm also like, who cares why? I'm also kind of like, I'm like, I do kind of want to know the science behind it. Like, was it not on American Netflix before or something? Like, why this year did it raise up in its fourth season? That's likely.
That was the Shameless effect, I believe, that it became like, Netflix
thing. Like, where did the hype, like, you know, like, did it just get licensed for American Netflix or, like, why? But then I was like, also, it's kind of mean to be like, why? I mean, it's great that it succeeded so much in Canada before then that it didn't get cancelled, like that we still have it, you know, going on, even though the world didn't know about it very much till now. But I'm really trying to kind of avoid this attitude of like, oh, well, like, why did it take you so long to watch it? And that's kind of like how I feel about that show, like on the whole, like that every, you know, like the people, because it's like 4 years behind and people are just picking it up. And I'm like, if that's okay, then like, why are we being like, oh my God, you didn't watch Killing Eve. It came out 2 weeks ago. Like, you know, like, come on. Like, that's so ridiculous.
Yeah. And I will say that like some of it's definitely just in my head. Like it's sort of like, yeah, I'm doing this to myself. Like,
oh no, but it is real, person. I think.
Yeah. But it's like, it's the internet culture. Pressure. Like, I feel like I need to like take a break. It comes down to that. It comes down to like reading where I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I haven't read this book. I can't tell anyone I haven't read this book. But at the same time, it's like, who the hell cares that I haven't read this book? But we'll get to something related to that later. But like, it's just, I'm looking forward to getting over that attitude and trying to sustain some like better personal goals with viewing habits in 2019, because I feel like, yes, all my shows are going to be back and I'm going to get on this like high of it. And I don't want to fall into a crash where I'm like, oh, well now I have nothing. Like, I don't want to do that again. Cause I did that this year. And I, listen guys, I cannot watch Hallmark movies for 4 months straight again, because it's been great, but I
you
need
can
to,
if you want.
Yeah, I know I can if I want, but I can't. I really need to take a break.
Maybe switch to Lifetime.
Yeah. I need to take a break. But yeah, so like, I'm just, that was my biggest gripe of this year, was like talking myself into a funk about TV, and also TV working against me, especially Freeform, just not helping the situation where like I was so, Shadowhunters was so good in the first half of season three and then it got canceled, which happens. That wasn't my huge, like I was kind of upset about it because it was doing really well as for what I thought. But the drama around its cancellation and the response of very important parties who probably shouldn't be doing what they're doing. Anyway, that's been a downer, because like, you're not going into something that you're excited about anymore. Now it's going into a goodbye. And so I'm trying to just get into healthier relationships with my TV shows. I wish I like had a show that I was obsessed about. That's like kind of where I miss that. I miss being like fully involved in a show, even if it's something I found late. Like, I found Dirk Gently late, and that was a tragedy because I found, knew it was over.
I know, I avoided Supernatural for over 10 years. So like, I found a record of Megan, who's been on this show, like asking me like in like maybe 2008, like if I, you know, oh, you should watch Supernatural, and it would have been in like its third season then. Like, it started in 2005. But yeah, I've been like, oh yeah, one day. And I'm like, yeah, I have been avoiding Supernatural for so long.
Yeah, so I mean, like,
it's never too late.
Yeah, it's never too late, but at the same time, like, I need to talk myself into not caring so much about everything else.
I don't know.
I think that's fair. I think it's fair to understand your limits, too, and it's okay to take that break. I mean, I'm envious of anybody who's able to do that year-end break where they're just like 1 or 2 weeks off of everything. I think that resets us. I think that does make for a fresh start in a new year. And I'm looking for that fresh start. I'm looking to find that, because it's been a lot. Like, just media-wise and news-wise, this world has been a lot this year. It's okay to feel like we need that grape to cleanse our palate. So if it's your Hallmark movies, Britt, I'm very happy for you. For me, it's just going back to the classics and refusing to watch anything new, hence me just watching Gilmore Girls for the rest of my life. I'm cool with that. I'm totally fine with that.
I just read a tweet that is so perfect for this conversation, and then I swear we can move on. But it's an entertainment writer. He writes for Entertainment Weekly. And he said, can't tweet my 10 best shows of 2018 yet, since there are still 53 hours left to squeeze in the 83 very important shows I haven't found time to watch yet.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like, same. Big mood for 2018.
Yeah. I mean, at least we're not alone. That's a good thing. And here's another thing, too. I'm going into my gripe. I'm hoping I'm not alone in this one, because when I was planning this with Natalie, I was like, I feel like a lot of people in the world have related to this in the past, maybe in the future, they're going to be curious about how Mitch has moved as many times he has and what effect that's had on him. My gripe of 2018 is not related to anything television or media-wise. Brittany, I loved yours for having it be that, but this is more of a personal one. Mine was that I don't like the apathy I've started to feel while moving, in terms of not feeling permanent anywhere, as I've moved as many times as I have. And that's in terms of relationships with people, the space that I'm in, and particularly with my things. That's the hardest part, because I'm like, oh, I can just get this and I don't have to worry about its state in a year because I'll be gone anyways. I'm trying to get out of that. And I think that's a 20-ish kind of thing to feel in your 20s. And I'm happy to let it go. It's a learning process. So to anyone else, it feels like they're that kind of tumbleweed that I know I've been for some time. You know, going out in the world and figuring out yourself. No, you're not alone. If you do fall into that apathy thing, it's a survival technique. It's when you put yourself through your own wringer, when you're going through that discovery period, you're going to find yourself needing to have nothing so that you can build up again all the time. If you hold on too much to things or to past relationships, even, you'll find yourself never fully getting a new ground. And I think that hopefully, if I turn this into a hopeful rather than just a gripe, I'm finding that now being back in New York, I'm finding that my roots are where I am right now. And that's good. And this is the foundation that I needed. I can have good things. I don't have to feel apathetic about them either. My space can be built up. I can have everything just the way I want it, because it doesn't have to, even if it is, feel like it's going to go away. It's okay to even build up and know it's going to go away. That's all fine. And I don't know how you felt, Brittany, too, because you said, you know, you just moved into your apartment. When you were leaving, did you feel like going in, I have to not worry as much about this furniture? Or did you have a more permanent mindset of like, these things need to be set because this is my new home?
I don't think I felt that way. I should say I've moved like 8 or 9 times in my entire life. Just cause like my parents were separated. My mom was a single mom. So we moved a lot, growing up all within the same area. Like I always went to the same school and like that was all fine. So like anywhere I've gone, we've sort of just made it work, and I'm kind of used to that attitude, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So like, even moving like back and forth between parents' houses, with like step siblings and stuff like that, it was like whoever was home, you know, we figured out what the room would be. Like, oh, we have this piece of furniture, we'll put it in this room. And we have this piece of furniture, we'll throw it in this room. We got this TV, we'll put it here. So like, I always feel like I'll just see something and put it together sort of deal. Like I've never had this like, oh, this is my childhood dresser. Cause like I started moving when I was like 8. So you know what I mean? Like there were still pieces that like came with me for a while, but after a while I was like, oh, we're moving into this apartment. There's not enough room. We have to get rid of it, sort of deal.
So right. Like, well, I'm sure this is also a feeling as you're speaking of children of divorce, as you stated, and then also of kids who are just leaving age 18 to go out to college, perhaps in the States. Mm-hmm. And Australia has their gap year. I think that
they don't have to have that. They don't have to have the
right.
Gap year. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But whichever way it goes, it's also an important message for anybody who may be home for like a holiday break right now from school, to understand like, you're okay to feel a little bit lost right now. It's going to find itself probably mid-20s, maybe 30s. I don't know if that's a trend for everybody who goes away. Maybe some people move to a college that's far away and they fall in love and they stay there forever and it was meant to be, and they can come home and it's all nice and clean. I never really had that experience. I've always had like also like my heart halfway, you know, back home where I wanted to be most of the time. But then also my other heart, half of my heart being lost in the adventure of it all. It's addicting too, that the adventure comes with a lot of adrenaline and you're like, oh, cool. What's next? Where can I go? Who are all these new people that I can meet? It's so much fun. It is. It's expensive, which is where I burnt out. But it's okay to burn out as well. Don't underestimate the power of just going back. It's not as humbling as you may think it is. It's more of just like, oh, it's the next step. That's what I've gotten out of my move back to my hometown.
Yeah. I mean, I moved to California right after college by myself, mm-hmm. and it was great. Like you were saying, that rush for like the first 3 months. And then, you know, it was December. It was getting close to the holidays. I wasn't home. I had like I had some friends, but like they were friends of friends, and I was working, but like I didn't really like the job, and I was like, so when my dad came to visit, I was like, oh, by the way, I'm going home with you. Like, I'm done. Like, I am done. And it was fine. I was like 21. I was still very young. It was the first time I was like halfway across the country and a flight away instead of like a 3-hour car ride. So yeah, I mean, there's no problem going home. And also, like, you know, when you go home for like Christmas, like, you know, you see a lot of people like, oh, I'm going back to like my childhood bedroom. Like, and that's one thing I always feel like I don't have, just because we've like, you know, moved around a lot and people are like, my whole family's like living in different spaces and whatnot. I mean, there's always room at the parents' house. That's not the thing. It's like, but it's not like, oh, my parents left everything the same. And like, I just don't understand that because I didn't have it. So it's weird to like, you know, see like even in movies and TV shows when you don't have something that like seems to be like common knowledge, like even like the Mayberry comment earlier, like, you know, I feel like everyone around here knows what that means, but it's sort of like an American sitcom type thing, you know, like, oh, right. Yeah. When I come home from college, my room's going to be turned into a sewing room. And I'm like, no, it's not. My mom has moved 3 times since I went to college. Like my room is may not even exist, you know? So it's like, it's like weird. It's one of those like disconnect things where I'm fine without having it, but other people like want that, like, oh, I'm sleeping in my childhood bedroom type deal.
Yeah. This came to mind when the new Lion King, quote unquote, live action, I don't know what else to call it, 3D animation, Lion King trailer, released. And, the idea was like, I don't know if even one of us tweeted this or it was a viral tweet, but, great idea to release the trailer for this new movie, where children or adults in their childhood bedrooms for Thanksgiving break will be full of nostalgia and they'll be more invested in it. And that's why the trailer, I'm sure, was breaking records and whatnot.
What?
I don't know there's like any factual anything to the record breaking part, but yeah, that's what I saw a tweet of. And I was like, I can see the cultural impact of that. I never really related to anything like that. Like, I'm home now, time for the nostalgia. It doesn't really fit that way for me, but I think for others, like you're saying, Britt, it may. It feels like a fictionalized world where you could have a childhood bedroom that's still like almost like a particular place that always will exist. I don't know that I could ever have felt that way either, being in a family of 5 kids. Like, you move your rooms around too much to even like get particularly attached to a space and the decorations.
Yeah, but when they show that on television or whatever, you know, like, you know, so-and-so going home to, you know, sleep in their childhood bedroom or whatever, like, I can't remember. Lots of shows have that. Like weirdly, the first one that's coming to mind is Michael on Queer as Folk. I don't know why that's coming to mind. There's the first example of it, but, like, there's a million of them. Is that real?
Like, no. All of my friends have childhood bedrooms. Like,
they're still decorating their old stuff. Like,
yeah, still has like signed like stage door, like two Kristen Chenoweth posters hanging in her room that's like painted bright purple.
Oh, wow.
Why would they not update the room and make it a different kind of space? Like, I don't understand.
It's like an altar. Why would they need to? Like, or like a snapshot of the past.
Yeah, but what did the parents need 3 extra bedrooms for?
Then they should move. Like, that's just, I guess.
Moving is just so much when your mortgage is paid off. You're like, okay.
Or have guest rooms for, like, the children to stay in as adults. Like, you know, like guest rooms. Anyway, I don't know. I can't imagine that. Also, because if I moved out of home, well, I mean, I am moved out of home, that kind of stuff, like my signed Kristen Chenoweth poster or whatever, if I really wanted it, like, I would take it, you know, like I would take it with me.
Oh yeah, I did too.
Like an adult, you know, like, you know, whatever.
Yeah, well, that's how I lived. Like, everything that was mine was in my like room, but it could go with me. Like, everything I have is with me.
Like, if it doesn't fit in the sedan, it doesn't come with me. Yeah.
I can't imagine that capsule, like that time capsule thing.
I mean, the first movie that comes to mind, too, as you were saying, Queer as Folk, is, for me, Brokeback Mountain, always. Because in the end, when he goes and he smells the jacket, and he's looking at his childhood bedroom, and I'm like, I just don't understand. Like, that was just for the plot of it all, but that was like adults. Like they were like in their 30s or their 40s in that movie. And,
yeah.
And you still have a childhood bedroom.
I don't know. Maybe it's like a parental, like weird, like parental damage thing. The parents are like too attached. I can't like make a like judgment on this because I just don't know. Like, I just don't know.
It's sort of like, I think it's more of a like, if you want to come home, I want you to feel like you can come home type of deal. Or when you're coming home, I want you to feel like you're home and not a guest in my house. You know, like it's more of a
yes, but like,
well, that's how my mom puts it, because my mom always feels bad that we don't have that. She's always like, "Oh, I just want you guys, kids, to come home and feel like you know, you're in your room." Like, you know, it's like, it's one of those, that's how my mom is anyway. So I feel like I'm projecting that on most.
Yeah, my parents do not have that. Well, my dad renovated the house that we were living in regardless, because he has a big extension at the back. But it's meant that like everything that was a bedroom is like not even a bedroom anymore. Like the internal walls are still the same, but like, the old master bedroom is now a... like a guest room with two single beds in it. My bedroom is now a bathroom. My brother's room is now a studio. Like it is like actually like a sewing room, craft room. So it's my stepmother's studio. And my dad's bedroom and office is like a big open plan, like double room with a walk-in closet that literally used to be our old living room and dining room, because there's a huge open plan living room kitchen at the back. So it's like totally the opposite. Not only is it not saved, it's like literally a different, not even having moved, same house, but completely configured differently. So I cannot imagine this at all.
Yeah.
I mean, sorry.
I feel like as an adult child, like, and all of my siblings are like, get rid of the house and like go somewhere where that's small and like, you know, like do what you want to it, like make it whatever it is. But I feel like when I become a parent, I'm going to be like, no, please come home. This is your room. We didn't touch it. Like, if you want to come home, it'll be fine. Like, I feel like I'm going to be that parent. But at the same time, I'm like, God, go wherever you want, go on vacation, like take a trip for a year and a half, you know. I'm like in that mentality, like telling them to go live their lives and do whatever they want to the house. But I feel like when I already know, like I feel it in my bones that like when I have kids, I'm gonna like keep the room.
Yeah, like I'm trying to think in Gilmore Girls, like I think Lorelai has her room with like boy band pictures still up, and Emily kept it that way too. It's like, if you have the space to do it, because you have like a giant mansion in that.
Yeah, show, I mean, if something happens and you have to do it, do it, or you want to do it, that's also fine too.
I don't know. Anyway, but Mitch, I'm more curious about like what you mean about this kind of disconnect and like what your gripe actually is. Like,
you
gripe about how you feel about yourself or about the actual move itself, like, or the circumstances surrounding it, or.
Yeah, the apathy is so bottled up. And this is like.
Well, give me an example of what it means. Like,
sure. It means that I came to the point where I didn't care where the objects in my house were going to, even if they were at one point special to me, even nostalgic in Denver.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And I just had to say, donate that, or if it's personal, throw it out, or if it's recyclable, whatever. You just lose all attachment to your physical goods, which then starts to feel like it's like a piece of you in a way, because you're like, I'm shutting off the part of me that feels nostalgia, that feels attachment to physical objects so that I can survive. That's one example of like a physical way of doing that.
Yeah, I can kind of relate a bit, because I will actually talk about this now and I'll do my other thing as my gripe. Because one of my biggest issues this year, Mitch, is that my house, the house that I'm renovating, is not yet finished. I'm not living in it. I had planned to be living in it by last Christmas, and it's now this Christmas. Like, there was an issue last year with the first building company, and then this year it got the work got quite far progressed and then slowed down because my builder was injured. So I was expecting to have like this new, like not perfect life, but like, you know, like go through, you know, having gone through everything I owned and like having everything even more permanent than kind of what you're describing, like having this house that I'm, you know, own and plan to be living in for a long time and like basically upgrading everything, like not, you know, doing the opposite of what you say, like, you know, oh, that doesn't matter. Like everything's going to matter like so much, you know, like get rid of anything that we, you know, I don't actually permanently want forever and stuff like that. And the kind of anticipation of that, that anticipation of everything being in place and then that being stopped means that like, yeah, my quality of life in my home that I'm renting, which used to be really nice, is now just like totally shit. Like it's just like, you know, like boxes piled up in the hallway of like t-shirts that I was going through and have given up on, like, you know, laundry not put away for weeks. Like I have had a similar apathy because of the stopping of moving forward, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That part's tough. That part's really tough.
And so, and you'd think that, especially in my case, when I know that I'm going to be able to move into the house eventually, and also there's the money, like the fact that there's, I've just paid like a year's worth of rent, basically, and paying for the house renovations. It's just kind of this, like, that apathy, a disconnect that it will ever change. So it's kind of the opposite of expecting it to change, but it seems to have the same result, Mitch, like in that it's like expecting, like knowing that it will change, like knowing that I'm stuck, basically, knowing that right now I'm stuck means that I've lost all motivation to like get things ready or better for, like to make it nice while I'm, to make right now good as well as just expecting the future to be good, if you know what I mean.
Because it's just so temporary, because you're like, I don't know that I need to care about this. Why would I? Yeah. I know it's changing.
Even though logically what I should be doing is getting everything here perfect, like, you know, going through every kitchen tool and every t-shirt and making, and like now, and doing that recycling process and all of that now. And I do, we have a bedroom called the packing room, which is like just stuffed with things, like boxes. Because not only do I have all the stuff that's here from my house, I have everything that was in the house of my mother's attic. So we had a family home that after my mother died was rented for a long time to tenants until it was like sold, and that my brother and I got them, you know, the funds from that, because it was like held in a trust till we were a certain age.
Yeah.
But there was storage space in that house in the attic, which was locked, like the tenants didn't use it. And all of that stuff is now in my shed as well. So it's not just my stuff that I've had to tackle before the move. It's all of that stuff. And maybe that's like a reason that I've like stopped as well. But you'd think that you'd be using this delay in, you know, moving forward. Because what will probably happen is they're like, oh, the house is going to be ready in a month. And I'm like, shit, I have more than a month's worth of preparation before the move, if you know what I mean. So I'm trying to really go ahead like next year and like, you know, literally do like a full day's work every, like, you know, like from, you know, like do 6 hours of work in the packing room every single day, like during the day, because I'm still not at a day job at the moment, because I was planning to go back to work after I was made redundant. I was planning to go back to work as soon as I was living in the new house, but I thought that was going to be like 3 months, and it's not been 3 months. And so it's all, yeah, that stuckness of like, I don't care about the now because the future is uncertain.
Yeah.
Is definitely something that's happened as well to me this year. So is that kind of what you're talking about?
That bleeds into what I'm talking about. And I'm hoping to let go of that apathy 100%. I don't want it. I'm trying to learn that from my mother, because she puts it this way. Basically, when I was in the college dorms, you need to make this nice for when you're in it, or else you won't enjoy your time at all. You're always going to feel like anywhere you are is temporary, no matter how permanent it seems. So do your best, do decorate it, do put everything the way it should go, and spend the time and effort to make it feel like you put love into your own space. That will transpire in the rest of your life.
That's definitely a need at the moment, because it's definitely for me both about like the condition I'm letting my house that I'm currently living getting into, and also the the effort to get everything ready to move as well. So, like, but yeah, it's definitely a combination of that work on the actual, like, you know, sorting and packing of my whole life, as well as the actual living conditions of the day-to-day life right now. So, yeah, it's really bad.
I know. And it comes down to a lot more than just the things of it all, because every object in your home likely has some kind of memory or feeling to it. And it's the fact of knowing you have to just get rid of things that you felt like you could keep forever, and then that you're not going to miss them because you have too many things that are like that, that you're just going to say, okay, I'm getting rid of that special mug that I got at the Bronx Zoo when I was in the fifth grade. And then you're not going to really think about it ever again because it's out of your sight. Yeah. You're losing those pieces of memory. They're the physical mementos that keep you the person that you are, but you're letting those go because you need to. It's an adulting process.
Yeah, I mean, my process for that, I will tell you, is that, like, I'm like, oh, yeah, these 7 things are all from my trip to London when I was 10, if you know what I mean. How about I keep 1 of the 7 things from that trip, if you know what I mean? Like, 1 item to remind, or, like, you know, notes from school, or, like, old birthday cards and stuff. Like, okay, how about I keep, like, 1 or 2 with the handwriting of every grandparent that's died, not every single one, you know, like, not, you know, like, keep it, you know, I'm trying to keep examples rather than, like, every item, if you know what I mean.
Oh yeah. The example part is very important there.
Yeah. And, like, as in, like, oh, I'm not going to throw out every birthday card. I'm going to keep, like, you know, 1 from, you know, the ones that had the most interesting messages, you know, or the ones that are, like, a handwriting example of, like, someone who's passed away, like, you know, and try and kind of do it like that. So that's quite difficult. And, yeah, but it's just really, there's a lot. And for me also, Mitch, because I've spoken about this illness that I've had during this year with this B12 deficiency of being also very, like, confused and not very resilient. So that's also been a contributor to, like, not being able to, like, get my head around doing a lot of this. So yeah, it's nasty. But are you living now in a place that you feel, like, secure in?
Well, for the time being, I guess I would have to be, because while being back in my parents' house, I'm not going to be spending too much time here anyways, because I'll be doing another bachelor's degree for computer science. So, it's kind of been a thing that I started in Denver. So it's a continuation of the coding I was doing there. So jumping off of that, I'm just going to be, you know, working, doing Hypable. And I'll probably find something at the college to do. Who knows? Maybe another library job and doing the full-time classes. So it's going to be like, this is just my rest stop. But the rest of it will just be me pushing forward and moving through it. So the amount of time I'll even spend here won't even matter. I won't have anything but probably that sleep time. I spent like the past month or two getting the spaces ready for that marathon up and coming, because if I know me, it's always when I get running, I don't stop. And that's what I'm ready for. I'm ready for letting go of a lot of the past objects and feelings and emotions and moving forward into, okay, you're just doing something, you're getting somewhere else rather than just existing. That's really important to me. I'm not just an exister. I'm not good at just complacency, I should say, you know. But Natalie, do please lead into your gripe, because I know it relates to some of what we were saying, not living in your house yet.
Okay, yeah. So I was trying to think about, like, what had affected me most this year. And the house is one of them. So not living in the house yet when I'd expected to be, and feeling stuck in that nothing, kind of this stasis where I should be using this stasis to actually, you know, catch up on everything, like get everything super prepared for moving, or, you know, just, you know, anything, any spare time that I want, because as soon as I move, I'll want to go back to a day job as well. So I should be using this downtime to, like, perfect every aspect of my life that I've never had time to do before. And it's just hasn't been able to do that because I've just been so stuck that it's had, like, an emotional, physical effect as well. So I really want to kick that off. But the other thing besides from that that's had the most, my biggest gripe of 2018, basically is the way that people act on the internet that is, you know, bad. Like, I know that this is going to, like, it's going to sound like in so many ways, but basically I've always had issues, like, you know, in online communities, fan communities, whatever, you know, people have always had really terrible behavior, like, you know, the kind of fights and determined bullying or tacking or, like, you know, the kind of stuff that people will do, like, in very dramatic ways online. And I've you know, seen that in a few places, you know, like, because I've always been in fan communities and I've, you know, experienced it a bit. But I feel like this year it's just been a lot worse across the board in terms of the way that people will talk to each other on social media. It extends even further past that. I think it's probably all a trickle-down effect from, like, politics and from the state of the world and, like, the state of society and what they're how against everything, you know, someone is. Like, everyone's against someone. Like, no one, you know, people are not really trying to be a community very well. But I personally have had the worst experiences, stuff beyond my wildest dreams, that in terms of how people will act online about fandom. Like, the Supernatural fandom is sort of famous for that. You know, it's been a hotly contested fan community for a very long time, and that was one of the reasons that I never wanted to watch the show. And when I did start watching the show, I was actually surprised at how nice a lot of people were, like the large majority of people. I thought that everyone was going to be terrible. I thought that even if you liked the show and you didn't hate the show, even if you were, you know, a person who genuinely loved the show, that you were, like, going to be creepy, you know, like, in weird, like, you know what I mean? Like, that the, yeah, even the lovers were going to be, like, not pleasant, creepy, and they would be selfish and terrible. But the Supernatural fans are actually amazing. Like, they're actually, you know, really altruistic. They've done, like, a lot of, like, so much philanthropy, and it's a community that's really, like, puts up its hand and is like, you know, if someone has a problem, someone else will do something. Like, here's an example. Like, I actually went to a Supernatural convention this year when I was in, well, I was in London and the convention was in Rome, and I went to Rome while I was in London because it's only like 1 hour away. And I, for some reason, and I think this was to do with my freaking brain deficiency this year, left like a bunch of stuff in the hotel. Like, I don't mean like a little bit, I mean like over 12 items of clothing, like probably 15 items of clothing. I think they were in a drawer and they'd like got pushed to the back and I didn't see it when I was emptying it. Anyway, like half my clothes, basically, I left them in the hotel and we were just basically like freaking out, and I couldn't get anyone from the hotel to really help me. And it was just like literally asking like on Twitter, like, hey, is anyone still at the convention? Like, is anyone flying back to London? Could you speak to the hotel and possibly bring this? And like some, you know, it was just passed around, and like someone who I'd never met, never spoken to, didn't know at the convention, was like, oh yeah, I'm flying back business class. I've got heaps of space in my luggage. I'm still at the hotel. So just tell me your name and I'll get it and bring it and we can meet up in London. And that was like a total stranger. And it was genuinely amazing. And people, they do so much kindness. And, like, that's a big thing of, like, a lot of the guys have charities. Like, you know, one of them, Jared Padalecki, he has a charity campaign that's about mental health, and they also donate a lot to, like, they've helped, like, a cyberbullying law. And then the others have had, Jensen and Misha did a campaign that funded a project that's not even Supernatural related. It's just they were the ones who gave the people the funding to kick it off, which is called I Am Alive. Like, so I'm alive. So it's like a hotline, like a mental health hotline, but for people who can't speak on the phone, like who are too nervous to speak on the phone. So it's a digital, like, I am texting hotline. And like, so they've got money to train officers and therapists and stuff to work those I am Lions. So basically, there's so much good that these people are doing and so much based in really promoting like love and kindness and treating people really well and kind of like, you know, the sanctity of life and community and all of that kind of thing. And yet the toxicity of the bad parts of this fandom are violent. There's no other word for it than violent. And the way that I have experienced and seen people experience the negativity of some of these people. And usually, I'll be very frank, it is usually people who have a certain idea about the show, a certain idea about the actors that is just not in line with anything to do with reality. It's not in line to what the show is currently about. It's not in line to anything true about the actors. They think that there's like conspiracy theories and that everyone hates each other or like, you know, that all of this kind of thing. And they have this completely falsified idea of everything to do with the show, yet claim to love it or to claim to love, like, you know, Jared or Jensen or whatever, and that like they're still there to support them through this horrible trial of everything about the show that's terrible. Like, it's insane. And it would be hilarious. It would be ridiculous and laughable, and it should be something that should be ignored if their actions weren't so genuinely threatening in like a real life way. Their delusions are beyond ridiculous, and it's the kind of stuff that should be laughable, except for the amount of trouble they cause makes it impossible to ignore. Because it's not just people saying shit. They have tried to report various people, like they've had, you know, have had people's jobs threatened. They've had all sorts of things. Me, myself, anytime I write something for Supernatural that they don't like, or if I say something on Twitter that they don't like, they'll go to Warner Brothers PR, the CW PR, the showrunner, about like how, you know, do you know that this woman is doing this or saying this or whatever? They have this delusion that they think I called Jensen Ackles a Nazi, which I love him and would never do such a thing.
Oh, my God.
I will actually flat out explain that situation. Let me tell you what happened. 2 years ago at a convention, Jensen said something which it was a bit of a misstep and it came across online pretty badly. And I completely also changed my mind about this after I actually saw the video because he was pretty badly goaded by the person that asked him. So he kind of had a knee-jerk reaction to a question at a convention that, with context, with video and stuff, was not that bad, but it circulated on Twitter. And I said, like, some stuff about it, not to him or anything. I just said some stuff that was like, blah, blah, blah. Oh, for him to, like, say this is a bit like, I was like, it's a bit like Sean Spicer of him because it was like an alternative fact. It was like the weekend that inauguration happened. Literally, it happened the same weekend as the Trump inauguration when that alternative facts joke about the crowd size happened, gotcha. You know, and every meme was alternative facts meme. So that happened. This was like 2 years ago. I didn't know who Sean Spicer was. Like, I'm Australian. Like, it was the inauguration. This is literally the world's introduction to Sean Spicer. He was a small idiot played by Melissa McCarthy who decided to call like a lie an alternative fact, if you know what I mean. That was my entire frame of reference. And I was sort of just tongue-in-cheek scolding with a meme. Because he later said whatever that thing was about Holocaust supporters or like Holocaust denying or something like that, these people have started spinning this idea that because I made an alternative facts joke that I called Jensen or compared Jensen to a Nazi.
Oh, my God.
And it's fucking crazy, right? But anyway, the point is they'll say shit to people at the network, you know, people in the show, and it's, I've had a lot of difficulty this year. They haven't done anything. There's not been like, oh, we're checking up on you. But there has been times when it has been so severe that I then feel like I have to check up, like that I have to be like, that I'm nervous until the next time I get an accreditation or something like that. You know right. what I mean? Like that, maybe this time if they're saying something so terrible, offering like fake proof of the terribleness or whatever, that, because they do, they construct like fake evidence. Like, and I'm sure that like a lot of these people have seen like this kind of shit for years. And I actually know that they have, like, you know, obviously I got invited to the 300 party in Vancouver, like, and there was like 20 people, 20 press members there. It's, I ain't in any kind of trouble, but it's created this culture of fear, and it's just so intrusive. Like, it's so, everything that I write about the show, or every kind of opinion that I hold, or every time that I am allowed to be near the actors, I am violently attacked for it. And not everything I write, most of my articles about the show, they now ignore, but like it's yeah. Usually any time that I have any access to the show, like in a interview kind of way or whatever. Earlier this year, they tried to spin that I was leaking information from the writer's room. Yeah,
I remember reading stuff about that. I'm like, come on. Like,
yeah, because I did a podcast. It aired on Not About the Weather with Richard Speight Jr. And it was breaking down a script that he wrote. Like, oh, no, he didn't write. He directed. Sorry, my friend Meredith wrote it. So it was after the episode had aired, and I was given the script to go through with him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that was okayed by the showrunner. Like, I had permission to have the script. The script was sent to me, and the script included, you know, like, stuff that hadn't necessarily made it to air, like deleted scenes and stuff like that.
Yeah, as most shooting scripts do.
Yeah, which is normal. And like, fans have gotten copies of them before as like prizes. Like,
yeah, you can win
them out and stuff.
Yeah, and you can even like buy them years later on eBay. It's not like,
yeah, it's not a big deal. But anyway, they'll take something like that, and they will basically, they tried to basically spin this idea that like people on the show were like leaking information to me, or that like, because I referenced something on the podcast that, oh yeah, like this part here, it says it was meant to be in, for example, that script, like there was a flashback that was meant to be done in black and white, and then they didn't end up doing it in black and white. Like, so, and there are a few deleted scenes and stuff, but it's like not a big deal. And that was something, for example, that ended up in like, what they took from that, they took that information plus like tweets that I'd made about like, I don't know, something random, being like, you know, defending a point that I'd made in an article. I'm like, I know for a fact that this is how it is because I've spoken to people on the show about that. But I was talking about like in interviews and stuff. I wasn't being like, haha, I know like secrets behind closed doors, because that's not true. Anyway, they took that idea and the script thing to combine into this, like spin this idea that I was getting information leaked from the writers' rooms.
My God.
And like trying to warn CWPR about that kind of stuff. So this is the kind of thing when I say that I'm like, it should be funny. Their ideas are so stupid that it should be laughable, but it creates shit that I have to handle, and I don't have the mental strength to laugh about it while handling it. It is still stressful and upsetting to handle. And I'm like, I'm also someone that approaches everything with logic and reason. And I'm like, how? Oh, I hit a wall, like trying to rationalize. I'm like, maybe they really believe this. Maybe I need to prove it's not true because they really believe it. A lot of the time it isn't even because they really believe it. It's because they've, like, they might not even really think that I'm getting information leaked, for example. They might not even really think that I think Jensen's a Nazi, for example. What it tends to be is a few ringleaders construct an idea as sabotage. And this sounds insane, but as like a personal, you know, they're like, okay, we don't like Natalie because we know that she... you know, they'll have something about me that they believe is true. Like, that, you know, like Destiel, for example, like Dean and Cass. Like, I quite like that ship. It is the prominent ship of the show. I like ships on most shows. But because I'm not, like, silent about being impartial to shipping, they think that because I like Destiel that I must hate Sam, like Jared, and that I want everything about the show to be, like, about Destiel or whatever, which isn't true. But they'll take one idea that they believe about me is true, or anyone, not just me, and because they have this grudge, they will then try and create like a high horse of real problems, real, quote-unquote, that they've constructed in order to like get me banned from having press accreditation from the show because they don't like that I like, you know, whatever it is that they don't agree with. Like, it's not that they genuinely think that I think Jensen's a Nazi or that I genuinely don't like him or that I genuinely are getting information leaked. It's that they want to find something to get me on because they don't like my opinions of the show, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Is there an issue with Death Seal, the ship itself, that the show has handled? Like, the production has said, we don't like that, or an actor? Is that what I'm getting?
No, no.
So then what's the problem with shipping Death Seal?
Well, I mean, yes, there's been ups and downs about it. You know, there's been people that really support it. There's been people that are kind of like, no one is in denial that it's a thing, that it's an easy assumption to make, basically. Like, Misha Collins talks about it all the time. Jensen is a bit up and down on it, but he makes jokes about it and stuff as well. Mitch, I mean, I'll tell you the real core of this, and it's a bit ridiculous to talk about it. The real core of this for a lot of them is that they think everything, they try to make everything about Destiel because they think that that is all that other people care about, because they don't. Like, the fact of the matter is that people who kind of like casually like Destiel are the kind of people who like also or seriously like it, some, you know, who, you know, means a lot to, are the same kind of people that like, you know, like Stucky or like whatever, Zutara, like a ship that's like prominent and not canon, but genuinely like a big, you know, big important thing that affects them watching the show. The thing is, all of the people that like Destiel, it usually means that they like pretty much everything else about the show. If they like Destiel, they like, you know, they like Castiel being there, they like the brothers, they like all the side characters and stuff like that. Destiel fans usually like the show as it is, with the extension of Dean and Cass's weird relationship being extended to romance. Like, so basically, like, Supernatural as is, plus extra kissing.
Whereas, as in there's already kissing that I don't know.
As in, like, Destiel for most people is what it means about the show, is the show exactly as it is, with that relationship which is already kind of like intense and different to Sam and Dean and Sam and Cass being romantic and not just weird, basically. That's all. A lot of these people who have this kind of a hatred and attacking and stuff like that are old school fans who ship Wincest, Sam and Dean.
I was going to ask if it was the War of the Ships. Ah,
it's. I think that they try to make it a War of the Ships that is very one-sided, because my gut feeling about these people, that the reason that they think that everyone is focused on Destiel when they're not, like, I've never written a freaking article about Destiel, and I could if I wanted to. Hyperbole has no issue with people writing about shipping. Like, I just don't want to do that because it's not really the main lens that I watch the show. Like, I read fan fiction, but I'm not like looking for moments for Destiel to become canon in the show like as desperately as they seem to think. I'd write shipping articles if I wanted to write shipping articles. I don't want to do that, so it's clearly not that big a deal. But my gut feeling is that they ship Wincest, like it's an incest ship, it's Sam and Dean, and inside the closed doors of fandom, that's fine. Like, that's like inside your deep fandom where a lot of things are taboo, that's not that big a deal. Like, that's whatever, they can do that behind closed doors and that's fine. Over the years, as shipping has become like a commodity, like something that the show is like shows in general are marketed with, like where they actually play into, like, you know, hashtags about shipping and, like, you know, that it's actually something that's talked about in public by the media, like that kind of thing. An incest ship isn't really going to be like mainstream acceptable. Like, it might be totally acceptable in fandom for some people. And even Game of Thrones is different, but like, I don't even really criticize that. There's lots of weird ships in fandom that, like, behind the fandom door is like not even weird at all. So that's not that big a deal, but it's clearly not something that can be publicly marketed, if you know what I mean. Like, they're not going to, like, lean into, like, Wincest shipping as, like, a hint, hint, nudge, nudge that the show itself or, like, that, you know, the media is going to talk about, whereas Destiel is. Like, it's a very basic, there's nothing problematic about that. There used to be something a bit problematic about it in that Cass was inhabiting the body of someone else, but that's not the case anymore. So there's nothing about it that would be like a problem
ethically if it became canon, you know? So it's something that they can play with, you know, as a marketing tool if they want to. So that means that Destiel is more publicly acceptable than Wincess, despite inside fandom that not being a big deal. And I've got a feeling, this is just my theory, but I've got a feeling a lot of the anger that has caused a lot of this drama that I've talked about comes from, even if they haven't identified it themselves, comes from a very severe bitterness that their ship is not as acceptable as a ship like Destiel. And so that they're trying to make everything about Wincess versus Destiel when it's not, because they have this bitterness about it. That's my theory, but I don't really care why it is that they're doing what they're doing. They just need to stop, because it's freaking psychopathic. And I cannot tell you the amount of hours and days this year I have wasted trying to handle this kind of shit, trying to either talk to these people to be like, why? Or talking to other people about like what it is. Because it's not just me as well. They will do this to the writers. They're not about me. Like, they're very abusive to everyone, including the people that make the show. Anyone that's not Jared and Jensen, incredibly abusive without any kind of restraint, without thinking that they're doing anything wrong. Intensely abusive to especially the writers. And because a lot of people who are not abusive don't feel like it's polite to like flood a writer's mentions with every thought that they've had about their episode, whereas the bad people who don't care about crossing boundaries will flood with everything bad that they think about it, then it looks like a real disparity. Like, it looks like everyone hates the show, but it's actually just that the haters are very loud.
Yeah, and totally.
Supernatural is just a microcosm of this. I feel like this level of boundary crossing in terms of how abusive people are willing to be is increasing in general. I think Supernatural's always been quite bad, but I think it's increasing in general in life. And it's just really stressful to me, and I don't know how to make it stop or how to not engage with it. Like, I've got so many people on mute, like, now, but I don't know how to not engage with it when it becomes an actual something that feels like an actual threat, you know? I also don't like, on a personal level, I don't like being told that I'm lying. Like, I don't like someone saying, you don't mean this, you mean that. I mean, and that really gets to me when people do that, when my motivations are twisted. But even that, I could kind of take a deep breath and walk away from. It's when it actually is a threat, and it's something that feels like a threat, or something that makes other people feel like they're useless, or, you know, like that they're only being criticized, or something that's actually going to have a real world effect. For an example, like an actor or something being like, everyone hates me, when no, it's like 14 loud people with sock accounts hate you because they're delusional. I've had to explain the context of this history and why these haters act like this to a few people in order for them to understand like where the hate's coming from, in order to invalidate the hate for other people, if you know what I mean. And so I've gone through this with other people. The way I'm explaining it to you now, I'm like, no, what you need to know is that their perspective when they're saying that is this. Like, this is the crowd of people that it is. This is likely what they actually mean or what they're trying to achieve by saying that. I've had that conversation like with people in fandom and people, you know, around the show and stuff like that. Yeah, there was a big thing in May when I did that episode with Richard and I had the script. There was a big drama then that resulted in like a lot of hours of handling. There's been a few others, and then a big, big, big issue after the 300 party, of course, because they didn't like that I was there.
Naturally.
Yeah, and it's just definitely the biggest, aside from my personal life with the house and the illness, got to be the worst of 2018 for me, is that how many actual hours of handling this shit have had to be put in. Yeah. I'd love that to change next year, but I don't know if it's going to, but I also hope that no one listens to this to stalk me and gets any ideas, because that's definitely happened. I'm definitely being stalked in a number of ways as well. Like, people having information about me from somewhere, or it's exhausting to say the least.
I can only imagine, because I've never experienced any of this on the level that you've had.
I mean, you remember we had a few like angsty people at Glee Chat, Mitch, you know?
Oh, well, yeah, that was totally a different thing. Oh, God. I almost forgot. It was almost easier to forget, honestly.
Yeah. This is like nothing I've seen before. And I've seen some really bad shit go down in fandom. I've seen people do really terrible things. And this is pretty horrendous. And I will say, like, to spin it as a positive, I feel like they're getting worse, because I feel like it might be a dying scream. Not that they're going to go away, but I think it's getting worse because I think that they've realized that what they believed about the show, the actors or the story, is never going to come true. And I'm not even talking about Winchester. I don't think they actually think that the show is going to end with Sam and Dean romantically kissing as brothers, you know? I don't think they think that. Don't worry. But there's some ideas about, like, what they think the moral of the show is, or what they think the relationships of the actors are and story. And I think that both the way that the actors have been acting in the last couple of years and the way that the show's progressed, particularly under the new showrunner, I think that they are getting worse because the show is proving them wrong so intensely, if that makes sense. So it's like they're reacting worse because they are unconsciously or consciously freaking out that things are getting worse than ever, because the show is actually going, it's verbally proving them wrong, all of the things that they were deluded about.
Right, it's going Destiel or otherwise, but not.
No, incest. No, no, it's not. And no, it's not about Destiel. I want to make that very clear. It's not, for me, it's definitely not about Destiel. It's more about the moral of the show and the ideas about the brothers, the ideas about what the end game of the brothers is. Even outside of Destiel or shipping, a lot of the opinions there are based in the idea that all Sam and Dean should want is for them to be alone together. A lot of the history of the show is that Sam and Dean, all they had was each other. What these people don't seem to recognize is that that was not a good thing, that that was a product of the fact that they were, like, traumatized and isolated, and the show has been, like, slowly repairing that. They're more stable, they have, like, a bigger family and all of that kind of stuff now. Those people, I think, more than any kind of ship, those people have internalized the idea that all they had is each other equals all they want is each other, if that makes sense, that they should choose to send everyone else away and choose to be alone together and, like, die hand in hand, you know, or something like that. Whereas the show is actually much more hopeful and positive than that. It's actually, they're able to grow a bigger safety net of family and friends and actually regain, like, the life that was stolen from them that meant that they were forced to be alone together. So that's a really positive thing, and it's got nothing to do with shipping. But that, I think, is the main key difference, that the idea that their circumstances of being codependent, a lot of people saw that as bad, and the show clearly sees it as bad, and it's something that they've had to heal from and, like, grow, whereas these people thought that was good, if that makes sense.
Right, to experience the beauty of other relationships with humans on a deep level that isn't just this one person. Right.
Exactly.
Which is a healthy perspective for humans to have. We all should have a round.
They want Sam and Dean to only care about Sam and Dean. Outside of shipping, forget shipping, that's the issue. They want Sam and Dean to be alone together and to choose to be alone together. I think that is the key issue.
It's so funny, like, finding, like, the little pinhole that leads to this waterfall as it goes down.
I'm pretty sure that's my theory, but that's the show's certainly proving that wrong. Like, the show is verbally, physically, you know, emotionally, subtextually and textually proving that wrong in every single way. And I think that that's why they're getting worse, because they either know that they're wrong, or they think that their pure version of the show is getting ruined. For example, that the actors are being forced to do all of these scenes that are so against what they would ever do and stuff like that. It's very stupid, but it results in real stress in what their actions, what their behavior actually does, causes a lot of real stress for a lot of people, not just myself. But I don't know, it's pretty intense. So Brittany, how are you feeling about watching the rest of Supernatural now?
I'm good. I'll watch it, but I'll watch it offline.
Yeah, I think that's for the best. I mean, that was my original plan before the person who was covering it on Hyperball quit covering it. I only ever planned to be offline with this show, so that's turned out differently. And I will say, what I will say about that is that if the bad outweighed the good about my involvement with this show, then I wouldn't be doing it. And the bad's real bad, so that means that the good is incredible. Like, it's the best relationship I've ever had with a show professionally, for sure. And my, you know, the people I'm friends with, all of the new friends that I've made are genuinely like some of the greatest friends that I've met in years. And so the good is high. The good is like, you know, 98 out of 100. But the bad is 96 out of 100, if you know what I mean, of badness level. So the bad's real bad, but the good is still better, because, so I'm still here. So, yeah.
That's tough, bound to happen. But, yeah, totally. Yeah. Any major fandom that's built in, you're going to find your district in a way. You're going to find your group of people who feel similar to you.
And this is the biggest online fandom, full stop. In terms of the kind of fandom that I engage with, transformative fandom, like fan fiction and fan art and stuff. There's, you know, people who, like, care about a TV show and stuff like that. Like,
oh, yeah, it's far outpaced what Glee was in its time, because it's longer now.
It's longer, but it's like, physically, like, in terms of, for example, on Archive of Our Own, where it's a fan fiction hosting site, I think there are more supernatural fan fictions than any other fandom at all. Like, so that kind of like level, or like, you know, and when Tumblr was, you know, functioning better, it was the biggest ranking, like, conversational thing on Tumblr. So for the kind of fandom that I engage with, like in social media and transformative fandom, like fan fiction and theories and meta and that kind of thing, supernatural is the biggest. So of course the bad is going to be the worst, I guess. Yeah.
But that's okay, though, because if you know what you're signing up for, you can know how to avoid it, and then you can know how to experience it in a pleasant way, which helps you avoid this cyberbullying in hopefully a good way.
It is kind of impossible to avoid it. Like, you know, I could avoid it by
going offline.
Yeah, I could avoid it by changing what I write about. I could avoid it by, you know, not going to press events. I could avoid it by not being meeting up with people on the show, not doing interviews, not being friends with anyone. Like, those aren't things that I want to avoid. I want to do all those things. So it's
the way I was presenting it was from the muting perspective. You know who to mute.
Oh, yeah. I mute people all the time. My issue is that when it's stuff that is a threat. When it's stuff that is a threat, basically, or when people tell me that stuff, people are saying stuff about me, like, you know, like I would love to avoid it, but I am pretty affected by it, but emotionally as well. Like, when I see it, there are some people who are just like, haha, this is hilarious. I don't care about anything they say. I care about things that people say, because I don't like being falsely accused of things. So I get very emotional about that, but I have been finding it more laughable, because some of the things they've done have been so bad, not just to me, like some of the theories that they've had, these ideas that they've circulated about things, been so bad that I'm like, okay, it's like clicked in my brain that they're not operating with any kind of logical function. Like, it's so crazy that I'm like, okay, I'm not giving this any weight, because this is so crazy. Like, I'm able to just like be free from caring. So that is increasing, but there have still been actual threats that have been things that I have to handle, and I really just want that to stop. So,
yeah. Oh, yikes. That's horrible, because I've never reached that level in terms of my video game coverage, because I've had some popular Smash Bros. Articles, and people come in with a very heated opinion against mine, because I'm purposefully getting in with a hot opinion. That's what's getting it popular. It's because it's how I feel legitimately. I'm not trying to stir them up just for the sake of it. It's because I believe there's an issue. I say it loudly. That's it. I think that's how we write, and that's what we're doing. They usually just go at the terms of, you're a noob, or you're so wrong. Like, the most I've gotten is like, stop writing, your opinion's horrible. But I usually share those and laugh at them, because they're not like physically threatening, you know, or they're not like trying to come after my
character. No, yeah, I mean, yeah.
You, which is how I can't, I can't, you know, accentuate enough how when I do that, I'm doing it from a very lesser level. And I don't want you to ever feel that I wouldn't appreciate the level of threat that you receive here, because that's scary.
I mean, a lot of people over the years have stopped covering the show because of this. Like, they've chased people offline. So
I believe it. Yeah, this reminds me of some tones of the Harry Potter fandom. And it just reminds me of tones of Glee fandom.
It's just ironic because, like, the things that the actors stand for and, like, give charity work to is all based in, like, I think most of the people who will do this kind of stuff will have, like, the logo in their screen name of, like, Always Keep Fighting of Jared's charity. And I'm like, if he knew the kind of shit that people were doing, like, in his name, in defense of him, because a lot of it is in defense of Jared and Sam, because, you know, he's the one not in Destiel. So, like, if people like Destiel, then they must hate him. And he's my favorite character, but they don't believe that, so whatever. But, like, I'm like, if he knew the shit that people were doing, like, while having his charity logo of kindness and mental health and stuff in their username, I don't even know how I would react in his situation if I knew that. So
yeah, he probably would be horrified. And the shame of it all is that no matter where we go in life, we're always going to find these bullies to an extreme too, especially in something popular. And it's best to be able to voice them very publicly, I think, so that those people cannot feel as powered as they were. Yeah.
Shame them.
Yeah, easily, because it's not okay to do the things that I've heard people have done to you. I am always aghast at it all. And you always have a big supporter in your corner with me there, because I've seen a lot of it for you over the years, and I'm just it makes me sad. You deserve better things, Natalie. You really do. But in terms of any other fandom bullying things, before we move on from this topic, Brittany, did you have anything to comment?
Shadowhunters fandom is just a hot mess.
Really? Do they do this kind of shit?
No, it's died down a lot. Mm-hmm. Because of the whole show being canceled, that there's not a lot of, like, problems with the actual content of the show anymore. It's more about, like, you're either all completely in on the fact that Shadowhunters is going to get picked up again, or you're not.
It's not getting picked up. Kind of like you're delusional, or, like, you know, like, you're, like,
yeah, like, it's
the,
like,
the people who have given up on not being picked up are, like, evil.
Yeah, yeah, they're like, you don't love the show because you don't think it's going to be saved. It's like, it's over. It's a money thing. I'm sorry to say that. Yeah. It's a money thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Sense8 is a bad example because it was a money thing and there was enough voice to make it come back. So I'm sure that's something that's brought up often in that conversation about Shadowhunters.
No, it's not. It's that, and it's Timeless, and it's Lucifer, but, and I will say this once, it's not The Voice. The Voice plays very little into the final decision.
The reality? Oh, The Voice. I thought you were saying the reality TV show Voice as if it was canceled and came back.
Not The Voice with the turning chairs, which cost a lot of money. yeah, it's... At the end of the day, it's what makes sense on paper.
Yeah.
But it has to. And CW seems to be able to afford these shows that we don't understand how they can for years on end, leading us to places that we are now.
Syndication rights.
That's true.
Good deals.
That is very true. So now we're going to go into our most positive things of 2018. And Brittany, you're our first voice here, talking about being a tourist. Please tell us how you feel about this.
So I had the immense, wonderful opportunity through my job this year to travel a lot more than I was anticipating. I wasn't actually planning on traveling anywhere in 2018. I didn't have anything planned. I didn't have any trips planned. But because of my job, I went to a couple of conferences. So I went to Chicago, which was great because it was my friend's last week living there. So I got to reconnect with her in Chicago. I went to Sweden and I went to Germany, and then on my own from Germany, I went to Paris and back to Scotland where I studied abroad. And I really
like I wanted to go, and I had this like, you know, this grand idea of like, I'm just going to show up in Paris and go where the breeze takes me. Yeah, no, don't do that. Go on a freaking tour with someone who lives there. Do one of the free tours. These people grew up in the cities. They know where to take you. You can say you don't want to see the tourist attractions. You want to see the Eiffel Tower. You want to see the little shop that was used to film Amelie. You do. Don't worry about it. So I like finally gave up on that. Like, because I went to Stockholm. And I did a pretty good job figuring out Stockholm on my own because I was working most of the time. Like, yeah. I was in a conference center for like 12 hours a day. But luckily, while I was there, there were 19 hours of sunlight. So I was able to like go out late and like explore like the historic places on my own. But I didn't have a lot of time when I was there. So it was just sort of like, okay, I'm going to go here, here, here. There wasn't time for like, let's take a tour and go to a museum. Like, yeah. It just wasn't built into my schedule that way. So when I came back from Stockholm and I had the opportunity presented to me to go to Germany, I was like, okay, well, I have one really free day in Germany because I was in Germany for work. So Munich.
Okay.
So I went to Munich, and Munich is relatively small.
Yeah.
There's like, you could do Munich in a day. And so like But what I did was I like planned it out with like a free walking tour online where like it could be self-guided. So like I was able to see everything I wanted to see. I saw like the Glockenspiel in the town center at 11 o'clock. It was beautiful. And then, but when I went to Paris, I like made sure. So when I was living, studying abroad, basically the money that I had to go study abroad with was like whatever I made at my summer job the year before. So not a lot of money. So I learned how to travel really, really cheap. And so when I went abroad this time, like I've been working for many years now and I like had some money put aside and I was like, oh, you can stay in a hotel and like all this stuff. But whenever it came
instead
time,
of a hostel and
yeah,
stuff like
yeah. But when it like came time to like book everything, I was like, why would I spend that much money? I don't want to do that. So like, while I didn't stay in a hostel, I like worked around Airbnbs and like, I, you know, I stayed in like cooler sections of the cities that had like good reviews, you know, like, so I tried to like be a tourist in that way, but then go on the pre-planned walking tours with a guide and like, but I didn't do like the tour that took you to Notre Dame because that was pretty easy to get to as a tourist. So I did the one that like took me like near Moulin Rouge and like all like these hills and stuff. And I ended up on top of a hill at sunset looking at the Eiffel Tower and it was gorgeous, you know, like little things
that. Wow.
I just became comfortable going on a tour and actually learning about the history of the things that I was there to see because like there's, I can go into Notre Dame and like walk around, but like, what am I taking away from that besides what I felt while I was there?
Totally agree. You're like, oh, there it is.
Yeah. So I was like,
I totally agree. I love walking tours and I should do more of them. But yes, I certainly have that kind of like, I want the information. Otherwise, I mean, there needs to be a storytelling aspect. Otherwise, you're just looking at a thing. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so like that was like my biggest thing with 2018 was like because I had all these opportunities to travel and go around, I really like sunk my heels in and was like, I'm going. Even when I went back to Scotland, I lived there for 6 months. I took a walking tour just in Edinburgh.
Yeah, you should do one with me and Leo in New York. We've done a few. When we were there last, we did the Brooklyn Army Terminal, which
That looked really cool.
It was freaking amazing. That was a couple of years ago, not the most recent time. But yeah, we do all sorts of them. Like, you know, it's really cool. Like, I really like the storytelling aspect. And Paris, the first time I went to Paris, I had some like goals. And hit them, but a lot of it, I was my own weird self-guided tours based on my own interests, like locations from Les Miserables. Like, there's a online walking tour of like this journey that like someone takes in Les Mis fictionally. And I also spent a day at like Père Lachaise Cemetery where Oscar Wilde is buried. So like I had like some aims for Paris, but like the cities I don't know like very well. Like I really believe in this. And I was actually trying to do one in Vancouver and I had it booked and they like show, they, I think they left without me. Like it was really weird. Like I was very disappointed because I was in Vancouver for a couple of days, but they, I was trying to do a walking tour and it was, they were like, yeah, we're expecting you. And then they were like, oh, you didn't show up. And I'm like, I was there and contacting you and no one picked up the phone. Like so clearly something's gone wrong, but that was very disappointing because I didn't really get to know that city, but I fully believe in them as well. So you're going to have to do some with me and Leo in New York and learn weird things about like the, you know, probably the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire or something like that, because Leo's obsessed with all of that kind of like stuff as well.
That would be a good haunted tour. That's what I always want to sign up for.
I was in Edinburgh right before Halloween. It was all haunted tours. Like my walking tour I did during the day, but it was just like all haunted tours. But you know, like I knew the history of Edinburgh just because I was like really into it when I was there and living there. But like it's still fun to hear. And the tour guide I had was great. She's like born and bred Scottish girl, loves Scotland. Mm. And so like you get their enthusiasm about the city, and she like showed us like this like cool place to like eat and stuff. So like, you know, it was like kind of, it was just interesting, and it broke up the day, and I wasn't just wandering and walking in circles and using my phone to figure out where I was.
Yeah, exactly. Like I really like to have the story aspect. So I think that's so cool.
You're reminding me now of when I was in my senior year of high school to do my London and Paris trip. My parents were saying, you can use your life savings on this. You should. You need to, basically, because your money will not be spent in a better way other than to do this. And all we did were walking tours, and I didn't appreciate them at all at the time. Like, I was 17, and I was like, what are we even doing? What is the world? Who am I? But I didn't really care about anything. But now, I think back to like, yeah, like my Eiffel Tower experience and my Notre Dame experience and my Jack the Ripper tour and my Palace of Versailles tour. Like I think about those kind of things all the time. I think about my regrets of not being able to go to like the Catacombs, for instance. There are so many ways to experience the world that you'll only ever know through those kind of walking tours. You'll never find that storytelling thing to the same level when you're doing it on your own, in my opinion. You need someone that knows it well, knows the script, but also knows how to answer your questions in an intriguing way. It's so much fun. It'll affect you for your life too.
Yeah. And it also helped that like, because I was by myself, because I went for work. So like when I went on to Paris and Scotland, I was already over there with my coworkers in Germany, but I left and traveled alone just because I had a couple extra days. And I was like, well, I'm already, the flight's already done. So like, I might as well country hop while I'm here. And so being by yourself, it also helps to go on tours and stuff, because like you don't have another person to be like, so what do you want to do? It literally is all up to you, so you can do whatever you want. So you could do three walking tours back to back, but you're also like then interacting with people, and it's in English, which sometimes is helpful when you're in Paris. And you know, it's like a nice way to not feel like you're completely alone the whole time you're there. So that was kind of nice too.
Yeah, there's something about the language barrier too that's helped by the walking tours, because you know you have someone that can just do all the translation that's necessary when you're traveling. That's a stressful part, like anything bus, train, or car related.
I had
so tough if you don't speak the language time of where you are.
I had such a fun time in Sweden figuring it out. Like my favorite thing would be like I'd get to the train and I'd be like, okay, I'm getting off at this stop, and I would have how you would pronounce it in your head. And then they would announce it on the train, and I'm like, wow, not even close.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't even pronounce Reykjavik when we were doing it on Sense8, so I can't imagine.
Mm. Oh, imagine Hernando as your walking tour guide. Oh.
He's so amazing at that.
I did a great one actually when I went to Rome, because I'd never been there before. I didn't do one in the center of Rome. I did one in where we knew we were staying on the coast. There's a place called Ostia Antica, which is like one of the oldest Roman ruins, like archaeological dig. It's like bigger than Pompeii. And yeah, it's cool to kind of walk around and be like, hey, that's old. But, you know, we didn't like know what anything was. And I did a walk, we did a walking tour there with a guide. And it was really good because she knew, you know, what everything was, like what the site, you know, like what building was what and what it meant, like, and like, yeah. So I'm so pro this, and I, yeah, need to, yeah, there are definitely some good free ones as well. And it's interesting because it's like, who gains from that? Like who, I've had paid ones as well that are kind of specific, but like, does the city put it on? Like, is it like a, just a service for like helping the city, or like, where do the free ones come from?
Yeah. I mean, I did all mine through like, I did one in Amsterdam when I was studying abroad, and it was great. And I used the same company. I forget what it's called. But they, it is a free walking tour, but it's done by a company. And, but like they, the tour guides work just off tips.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so like that's how that, I guess they get paid. But the one girl, my tour guide in Scotland, she was saying, she's like, I, this is my full-time job, because she could give like 2-3 tours a day and like make a pretty good amount. But, you know, they do stress that like this is what I do, and it's because I love talking about where I live. And she was like, she, you know, she went to school for history, and so she's like really into it.
That's cool.
But yeah, it was, so that's my hype for 2018, is that I became like, okay, not just like, you know, you can make it look like you winged it on Instagram, but you'll get a better caption if you can explain what you were looking at when you take your picture. So,
please, did you, I have to ask now, did anybody here go to the catacombs? I need to know if you did have a tour or what the hell went on.
You, I think you, it is guided. Like you can't just go.
Oh, you can't just go in.
No, it's like an attraction. Like,
yeah, you have to have like, again, my friend Megan and Cass, both of who have been on this podcast, both of who are in Rome with me, they did a Roman catacombs tour the day before I got there. So they did that tour. They did a, not a Paris, Megan's done the Paris ones as well, I think. So yeah. Yeah, I don't like skulls. I don't like bones.
Yeah, the catacombs, you can't just walk down. Like you, it's paid. Like it's a sort of like if you went to the Tower of London, you can't just walk into the Tower of London. It's sort of like
right, which is spooky in its own right. That was so much fun. I get jealous when I think of the catacombs because of the horror movie As Above, So Below, and they're in there and they're just being chased by monsters, and I'm like, that seems like fun. So maybe one day I'll make my way back to Europe and I'll be at any given catacomb. I think it'll be exciting for me. But that's just my twisted dark ways, I guess. On to my hype now for 2018. It's the resurgence of video games into pop culture. It's been great to know that the thing that I've been backing for years, this industry, is now becoming extremely mainstream and is becoming of interest to people I never would have imagined it ever would have. It's great to hear from like relatives or friends that are not ever in my mind as being like, yeah, I would own a Nintendo console, as now being super into it, being into like, for instance, even Pokemon Go or any given like reality game that you can play on your phone. It's amazing that the reach is getting the world to understand the beauty that I've seen in this industry, in this media, for such a long time. It feels like it's like a big payoff too, because I get to write about it. I'm so super fortunate that I do. And as I am observing and as I'm watching everything unfold, I can't, it's just like what I was describing, how I was feeling in New York City in Times Square. You don't have enough eyes to see it all going on, or I guess enough hours in the day to play it all and to feel it all. There's too much quality content coming out. It's in a bit of a renaissance, even, I'd say, the video game industry. And it feels so, I feel so lucky to be alive at this time. I feel so lucky to be actively engaging this media at this time. I know it's a unique period right now, and I know it started right around when Pokemon Go came about, of all things. I know that that's what brought it in. I can't get enough. I think this is all good. I don't see any negatives to things like Fortnite becoming big and popular and crazy. I think that that's fun. I think that's good. I think this is a way for society to grow and to expand and to find that there are more ways than just books, television, and movies to experience your day-to-day life. It's not such a Dungeons and Dragons hidden away thing, which Dungeons and Dragons should get step bag stigma for no reason. It doesn't have to be so stigmatized.
Yeah, what?
Dungeons and Dragons, like the role playing game, which is even video games, or like World of Warcraft.
That's also got a resurgence this year.
It has. So all of this kind of like
way.
Oh, and
it's interactive storytelling is kind of, I think, what you're talking about, as opposed to just
existing in it.
I am not a fan of interactive storytelling because I honestly like to have the story thrown at me and be hands off. But for people who do, whose mind works creatively in that way, mine does not. I'm not like a fiction writer, and so that's like a lot of it. But both D&D and video games are interactive storytelling where you're deriving pleasure from making the story and participating in the story. And they've both become massive in a different kind of way. Like D&D has been like really re-entered like day-to-day pop culture in a way that it hasn't in a while. And right. I feel like that might be related in terms of what it offers the consumer, you know?
I think it's a great escape. I think that it's not that we're really in a depression, but I remember learning in history class that during the Great Depression, that the entertainment industry was thriving because people wanted an escape from the world. I think this was the perfect year.
I think that we are closer to being in the Great Depression than society has been in some time. So that would make sense. It's a reactionary freedom, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, you would think that anything being a luxury would be excess and not needed during that period of time. It's the opposite. Mm. It's like you scrounge up what you can and you save what you can so that you can get that escape, as opposed to it being...
Yeah, that's true.
Along with this embarrassment of riches, it's just it's so easy to access things in ways that it wasn't. Technology is so much less expensive than it used to be. And once you meet your needs, you're probably going to be looking into either saving or entertainment. And it may just fall into what kind of smartphone can I get to play the best games on it, even. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole other part, that the technology in your pocket could outpace the one that landed on the moon 100 times fold, right? It's so weird, though, because I've never known that world without this extreme interest in video games. It's only ever been my world. So to see everybody else catching up to it, I'm like, where have you been? Like, I've known this for a while. It's not like a gatekeeping thing. It's like a confusion. It's just like, I don't know what turned you so on to it, but I'm cool with it. I'm not going to judge it. Just come along for the trip, I guess. Like, if this is what you think you're missing, then come on in. Let's all join in and have a fun time with it all.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't know if either of you two have done anything even smartphone wise, game wise. I think when I talked to you, Natalie, last about video games, you're like, I still have never touched a game. I don't know what downloadable content was our conversation.
No, I both lack physical coordination for video games, like hand to eye, like independent hand movement, like having both of your hands doing something at once. Is that something that you have to, like, you know, you hold it and like finger one press, you know, one. Yeah. I can't use both my hands at once in that way. And number two, that what I just mentioned, that interactive storytelling of like engaging and change, if it's story based as opposed to just like a race or something, you know.
Yeah.
I don't really like feel like that's something that I'm very good at engaging with, like being a part of the story, like same as D&D, where you're actually making things up or making choices in how the story's gonna go. That is not something that I want from storytelling. I want it to be thrown at me whole. So it's not for me, but that's, I think that for some people it is they're able to engage with stories better when they're a part of them.
Mm, yeah, for sure. Britt, I'm really curious as to your perspective on this, either looking at it or, if you are experiencing this renaissance of the video game industry right now, how are you feeling about the fact that it's so a part of pop culture right now?
Well, I'm a little nervous for my nephew's well-being with Fortnite. I don't like how much he's playing it. and he's a little
young
for it.
What is Fortnite?
It's a shooting game. Yeah. It's like Call of Duty.
But like kids are like
obsessed with it. Like,
because it's like cartoony.
Yeah, but anyway, beyond that.
Yeah, I don't know what that. I don't know what it is. They've referenced Fortnite twice in Supernatural this season.
Oh my god, have they? What
it is. Yeah, not
well,
the main.
Hey, it does
character.
Touch your world. See.
Not the main characters, but like people that they've met. Yeah. So yeah. Anyway, carry on. Carry on.
But that being said, my younger brother, he's 25, bought a Switch, and now I'm like, well, I want to be reconnected with Mario Party and Mario Kart, and like, I grew up playing video games, but only like, we had a Nintendo system, so like, we had a Sega when we were little, and I liked Mario games, like, that was my jam. Liked Mario World and Super Mario Brothers. I had all the Game Boy games. I liked like games like Banjo-Kazooie, like, you know, stuff classic. Like that. I don't like games like, I would never play Red Dead, like Redemption. Like, that just does not appeal to me.
Heavy storytelling.
And they're the ones that, like, and Mitch, like, to pass on to that, like, I definitely see them in day-to-day life in what you're saying in terms of, like, scrolling Tumblr, like people who I know who, you know, write fan fiction for, you know, whatever, like Star Wars or like whatever, then, like, you know, you see people shifting into fandoms, like of the character, you know, of something new. And I've seen quite a lot of Red Dead Redemption, like, fandom, like people being fans of the characters and shipping them and drawing art of them or writing stuff and, you know, like that kind of thing. So that level is definitely, you know, there's some games that are like that. Yeah.
Yeah. There were like 10 of those this year, if not 20, that were like that massive
games. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was crowded. It was a crowded space to try and enter into, to write about. As you're saying, Britt, yeah, like the Nintendo Switch is a whole different thing because it's really hit its stride this year because it came out last year, maybe 2 years ago. I lost track already. God. But yeah, Mario games aplenty on that console, and they're all great. There's really not a bad one. It's almost like we're back in like the Nintendo 64 days or the Nintendo Wii days.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's like hitting me because like I brought like a GameCube, my brother's like old GameCube to like college because all my friends like to play Smash and like Mario Kart. It was like a big bonding thing because everyone grew up with it, and it was more like nostalgic and homey, like when we were in college, like freshman year, like sitting around together, like anyone could walk in and pick up the controller because we've all played it before. And then, but they like in my day-to-day life, like I have this game on my phone called Free Flow, which is basically just like connecting the dots, but like you have to like connect them all.
I've heard of
and
that
like make it, it's great, it's my favorite game. But I'm almost done with it, so I don't know what I'm gonna do.
Oh no,
I'm out of puzzle packs.
I've been playing a game called Unblock Me on my phone since like 2007, and it never fails to amuse me because my brain has learned the puzzles, but it's so relaxing.
That's what I play at night or like after work, you know, because like it is very calming, but it keeps your brain going a little bit, like it calms it down.
Yeah, even if it gets as simple as my favorite bubble shooter, that's my favorite if I need to listen to like a book for like study, or if I'm just having trouble getting through audio that I want to listen to because my brain won't stay active. And that's kind of what I think, and this is interesting to me that culture can now evolve into having a game console, that kind of like flash game or like phone game has now evolved even more, especially as I'm saying once again with Pokemon Go. That was a big resurgence on the Nintendo Switch when the new Pokemon game released, because that brought in this massive series, even more fans that had maybe dropped off. And that is just going to continue to grow. It's also insane, as I was referencing with Smash Bros, because I'm writing about a game that's so popular and that's like outpacing the sales of like any game of its kind in insane ways. It's also hard to track. It's also weird.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's just so interesting. Like that, like, cause I feel like what you mentioned, I feel like that they've been, you say, oh, you know, you've been into games your whole life. But you know, you didn't realize everyone else was. I haven't been into games my whole life. And therefore I thought that everyone was just into games without me. And I didn't realize
how much ups and downs there was, you know, mm-hmm. Like, because what you're saying, you guys had like a Sega and stuff. Yeah, my brother did. I could have played it. I never had the drive. Like, I just never had anything in me that made me want to do that. So I just never had that desire in that way that you apparently like did, as like everyone did it. Like, I did not. I was not the everyone. But it was not because I wasn't allowed or anything. I just, there was just nothing in me that made me want that. And I'm just interested, like, what you think that drive was. Because I was definitely more about the, like, books and stuff. And again, I'm wondering if it's that element of wanting to not participate, if you know what I mean.
I think it was an influence of my elders, because my father, I am assuming, had to have grown up playing like arcade games. That's where this trend starts, going back into the 80s and the 70s sometimes, where you'd play Pac-Man and Galaga and Donkey Kong and Mario. And then as that grew up, it became the Game Boy. The Game Boy was a revolution.
Yeah, it was pocket games.
My brother had a Game Boy.
Yeah, my brother had a Game Boy. I could have had a Game Boy, but asked for one. I just didn't like. It was just. I don't know if it was like a. I don't think it was like a girls' boys thing, because I never cared about that. And they had girls' color ones anyway. I think I had a Tamagotchi once, but like.
Oh, the Tamagotchis are great. They're coming back sometime. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just wondering, like, what makes that like desirable or not desirable to a kid.
I remember there are two specific forms of media that got me into who I am today. Harry Potter was the book everybody was reading, so I tried to read it before I could read, and I couldn't, so I kept trying hard at school to get to the point where I could read Harry Potter. And then Pokemon was the next step, because I just learned how to read from books like Harry Potter. I decided I was going to put that to use in this active storytelling. I was learning words from these things. I was learning how to write from these things. I would then write fiction as a kid. I would write like a Christmas fiction, like every Christmas for some reason. I still have these. It is a drive for me to have that storytelling element, because writing a book, writing a novel is such an investment. But when I can just involve myself in terms of an observation way, it feels more rewarding, because it feels like I've earned it in my own unique way, and I don't have to have the critique as much as like I've created this thing that now needs to be bought, I guess. Now I can just have my thoughts. That's where it comes down to. So if I had to track the roots of it, it's probably Harry Potter, as almost literally everything in my life seems to be, believe it or not. But
Was Pokemon a game or a TV show first, or it was cards, wasn't it? Like swap cards? Like what's the origin story of Pokemon?
I don't know how I'm going to mess this up, and I really desperately shouldn't. They all happened really close to each other. It was the game first. It was the game first. It was a Game Boy game first.
What kind of game?
It was a role-playing game. Like, you had to walk around in the world, talk to people, and battle. And you had to win. You had to become the master. And then, after that, they had an anime, the cartoon that's still running right now.
Yeah, yeah, the show that was like a scripted series.
And cards came along with that, further making this an insanely popular trend, because it was all about cards in the 90s. And from there on out, it just continued, and now we're into Pokemon Go, I guess.
And Detective Pokemon.
Detective Pikachu, I know.
Detective Pikachu.
Pikachu's talking now, I guess.
So weird.
It never stopped. Ryan Reynolds, of all people. I mean, Deadpool is talking as Pikachu. Just put that in your head. Started with these little 8-bit characters, and we're just roaming around in a Japanese land. It was based off of Tokyo, I believe, the first game. And now we're here in a very Americanized version of that, with Hollywood stars doing it all.
I mean, I think Detective Pikachu, it looks bizarre in terms of like the actual look of it. But I will tell you what I think is interesting about that, because it plays with the idea of like it just plays with the idea of like the development of something in a world. Like, it's like, you know, the way that like Detective Pikachu seems to depend on the idea that like it's not telling the same Pokemon origin story over again. It's just operating within a world where Pokemon exists. And in the same way that what I was talking about on Rewatchable, like with Sense8, like that you could do any kind of show that was about like a cluster, if you know what I mean. You could do a romance, you could do like a, you know, like a hospital drama. You could do any kind of show with the kind of like background that clusters exist, you know, and that sensoriums exist. So that's kind of how I feel about Detective Pikachu, that it's like a world where it's, you know, a totally new kind of movie just using the concept of a world where Pokemon exist. And so that's kind of interesting, but it also looks kind of terrifying.
It does. Like, why is everybody fuzzy? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. The fur really threw me. I was like, okay, this is weird.
Because anyway, every other 3D model of them has always only ever been, like, smooth. Food. They never have fur. They're like a dog. Right? Huh?
They are animals. They're like a mammal, right? They're still an animal.
And they lay eggs, so I don't know. They're from space, okay?
Do Pikachus lay eggs?
Oh, they do. Every single Pokemon can lay an egg. They came from a meteor in space. And there are real animals in the Pokemon world. They're just not significant. We're like in an AU of planet Earth.
So there's like a dog and a fish. They're just not Pokemon.
They're not important either.
They're like alien invasion.
The Pokemon are. Like, they're like the invasive
Pokemon
species.
Pokemon is the story of an alien invasion, basically.
Yes, absolutely.
I did not know that.
It's a deep cut, honestly, so I'm happy we got there.
I mean, that's another example of that video game culture becoming, you know, more prominent.
I mean, they're not like a negative or like, you know, they're not bad. They came along as part of evolution in the world, and they've existed in that world from as far back as history as they can recall. So it's a deep cut in a lot of ways.
Wow.
But I'm happy we got to that point, because now we're at Detective Pikachu and they're all around a New York City lookalike and they're having fun. And that's just the world we live in these days, that furry, creepy Pokemon are going to be voiced by Ryan Reynolds. And we're just going to have to deal with that.
We are just going to have to deal with that. Very, very bizarre.
I know. But video games will continue to go on in our culture, and I'm sure in many more crazy, humongous ways that I could not imagine. And I'm excited to see where that goes. And I'm excited to continue to write about it, to observe it. And I'll use as many eyeballs as I can to see things like the Red Dead Redemption 2 billboard that I saw in New York City's Times Square. I did take a picture of it. I should have tweeted that yet. It's just a lot. It's a lot to take in. And I'm ready for the roller coaster of it all. So go along with me if you want. Maybe start playing Pokemon Go on your little smartphone and see what life is like in the dark side as it is. All right, so we have you, Natalie, as our last point for our hypes for 2018. What is your segment of hypes?
Yeah, my major hype, one of my favorite individual hype, individual occurrence or kind of situation in the world, was the royal wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. So Meghan and Harry, the wedding of the year, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, it just means a lot to me. I just have a lot of feelings about these people, and I have my whole life. I can't remember if I've talked about this on this show before. I love the British royal family, especially the boys, William and Harry. Since I was growing up, they were the first people whoever I ever had empathy about, like in a celebrity way, like in a, like, you know, celebs, they're just like us, kind of like my care about them as human beings, which started when I was very young. I really feel like I've talked about this before. I can't remember. But it grounded in me a very deep empathy for people in the spotlight who maybe are not, I mean, they're a massive example because, like, they didn't choose to be born and they didn't have any choice in what their life was going to be. But, like, even people who do something in the public eye because they are successful rather than born into something still don't ask for, like, a lot of the boundary crossing and a lot of the, like, you know, sensationalization of their lives. And I used to have dreams when I was a child about William and Harry when I was probably about 7 or younger, and about how I would have these dreams about how they would come over to my house to, like, play, and it was, like, scheduled into their lives as, like,
an escapism, like as in a, like, this is where you get, you know, what you're doing, like to be normal, if you know what I mean, like that it was like a scheduled normality escape thing. And I'm like, that's probably quite weird for a child to have those kind of dreams.
Yeah, a little bit, but cute, I guess.
But it's instilled in me both a deep love of them as people and what they've chosen to do with the position that they've been born into. And in general, I think it grounded in me a very deep, or it was kind of the first sign of a very intrinsic empathy about people in the public eye and that kind of thing. So it means a lot to me. And Harry especially is just such a wonderful person in what he's chosen to do with his life. You know, he and how he's addressed like the stuff that has been a problem. Like he's been very frank about, like, especially in recent years, like admitting that he really went off the rails because he didn't have proper grief counseling about his mother and that kind of thing. And like he's done a lot with mental health. He's done a lot with like he was like the patron of a new like mental health service in Britain. And he agreed to like come and do an interview about it. And I remember the girl who wrote it writing another piece. Like she published the interview and then she published like a reaction piece of herself, if you know what I mean, being like, so like this is what it was like to have this happen. And what she was talking about was like she expected the interview to be like very much like, here's why it's important generally to do this, you know, like to you know, like kind of as a spokesperson. Mm-hmm. And he like came in and sat down and was like very candid about his own experiences. And she was very shocked by this. And I thought it was very like, it was just very good, especially because there's a lot with the royals that's like, there's clearly a set protocol in what like tradition would prefer them to do, if you know what I mean. And the boys especially have really kind of taken their lives back from that and have in a way that's very good for their, you know, what very good for the world, in that that like we're in this massive position that's massively respected and, you know, financially very stable and all of that kind of thing. That, and we're gonna, so if we're stuck in that, we're not going to like play along with the old rules where we don't have feelings and stuff. We're going to actually use the platform as the world adapts to do more. And so I love that about them. And Harry, you know, Harry's done that, William's done that, and Meghan is just such a wonderful addition to that because she is American, like very progressive, not white, you know, like any number of things that are like a real shake up in a good way that kind of, you know, is going to support that work in the public eye. So the fact that they've gotten married and what they've, you know, been doing together and apart, like, you know, like with their activism as royals is amazing. Meghan's first endeavour of her official endeavour as the Duchess of Sussex was the funding and support of a cookbook for the residents of the Grenfell Tower fire in London, which is right where near I used to live in London, that whole big apartment block burning down. And there was that, all of that drama about that and like the, you know, the conditions of the building and stuff. She found a community kitchen who was like all of the ex-residents who, you know, had been, you know, put up in like kind of, you know, hotel or hostel accommodation and, you know, lots of immigrants, lots of people of different cultures who, you know, relied on cooking. So they founded a community kitchen for those people to all come together and like cook together and either make meals to share together or to take home from their families and trade and stuff. Meghan discovered this place when she moved to London and started going there privately as a guest, as a friend and stuff like that, as a kind of private supporter, and then ended up making them her first beneficiary as a charitable cause. They, you know, she funded, you know, the publication of a cookbook of all of the different recipes of the people there, and it's now able to be open. The place is able to be open 7 days a week now, and, you know, a lot of the people are, like, Muslim, like hijabi women and stuff like that. So it's kind of, like, really, it's stuff that shouldn't be that progressive for, like, a normal person, but like because the royals are so like they have been dictated in such a way that's so set, like there's just a lot of positive change that's come of all of this. Plus it's like just like it's like a, you know, not like a fairy tale, it's like a awesome,
it's like a nice break from reality.
It's like an awesome chick lit novel, you know, like of this American actress who's like become a royal family, you know, like, you know, member in Britain, and like, you know, the wedding. And then of course they came here to Australia as well. They had their first royal tour was here in Australia. Harry has come here quite a few times. So Australia, New Zealand and Fiji, like Commonwealth countries. But Australia was really awesome. Like the stuff that they did here was really great. And they, again, like they, it was because Harry runs this, the Invictus Games. I'm not sure if you know the Invictus Games mm-hmm. in America, but like they did one in Florida. I think Obama was, because Obama's friends with Harry, so that they did that together. Sydney had the Invictus Games, and so he was, they were there for the opening and closing ceremony of that. And gay, you know, they were like very involved with all of the veterans who were participating, and also like at the closing ceremony, which I went to, they gave speeches. They each gave speeches. Meghan's was in support of the family and, you know, of the people who have come to, like, thanking the people who created the funding for the families of the veterans to be able to attend and stay with them and support with them during that period. Mm-hmm. And Harry's was about the athletes, but again, was completely about mental health. It was like talking about like, you know, post-traumatic stress and like how, like the shaming around mental health. And again, he like went like off on this like really deep tangent about mental health that I was just like very shook by in a good way. And I just loved that they got married. I love that I got to see them this year when I've never seen them. Harry's done a couple of tours here before, like, you know, walk, you know, when they go and shake hands in public and stuff like that. But I've never, I didn't really feel comfortable like queuing up to do that, you know. But going to actually see a seated event where there was a speech was quite good. And where I was right on the side of the stage, side onto the stage, which meant I could see behind the curtain, like the backstage area, people waiting to come on. So like I saw like after Meghan's speech, like he was there waiting for her to get her and stuff, and like, you know, they hugged and stuff, and it was like very cute. And it was just a good year for me and my relationship, my distant relationship with Prince Harry and his now wife. And it was just, yeah, it was just, there's just a, yeah, like it is a shit year. And they were just such a nice, positive, just, you know, not even distractive, but like positive chain, you know, force for good for me. And I think a lot of people, I know Ariana is obsessed with Meghan as well. I've got Meghan's cookbook here. It's really cute and great. And I've never seen Suits, by the way. I don't know that show at all, but I...
He's in a great Hallmark movie too.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, that's so cute. So, yeah, Brittany, were you following the Meghan and Harry saga this year?
Oh, of course I was. So I was.
Yeah, I was also in London when the wedding was on in Windsor. On that trip when I went to Italy and London, I was in London when the wedding was on, which was really, I didn't go there on purpose for that, but I was really glad that I've never been there for a royal wedding or anything like that before.
Oh, well, I was in school in Scotland when the first prince
William and Kate.
Yeah. So we got a day off. It was great. But my friends and I went to Portugal and we watched it in a little cafe. It was great. But for this wedding, I was actually on a work trip. I was in Chicago and I had conference stuff all day and it was on at 4 a.m. and I was up and like my friends and I had a group text going. It was great. Yeah, we were really into the first wedding, and I love the royals. Like, I love, like, the, just, like, the royal roundups online. I'll read everything. You know, I love a good royals thing. And, yeah, the wedding was great. I watched the whole thing. It was incredible.
It's interesting about the relationship with it in America, because they're not your royal family. They're my royal family. The Queen is on my money, if you know what I mean. That, like, it's so... So, they come here, like, a lot. Like, not a lot, but, like, every now and then, you know, like, and because we're a Commonwealth country, and so it's kind of like a, you know, it's part of our culture, whereas I feel like America has this really funny, like, observer, like it's more of like a celebrity relationship with them that I really enjoy. But
I must have left out in a very anti-George Washington way that we don't have a royal family.
I mean, you guys got rid of them.
Yeah. We said goodbye.
You'll be back, and we did.
Oh, well, was that this year as well? Was the Hamilton Gala this year? Was that in 2018 when Hamilton because did you see that?
No.
Harry and Meghan, they did a special because Hamilton's open in London now.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that was earlier this year as well. This is freaking, this year's been so
long. I know. That's where I'm like, this happened?
Oh, my God. Yeah, no, it was literally only in, like, it was only like in August. Jesus, that's not even that long ago. Yeah, there was a Hamilton gala in London because the Hamilton show is on now in London, and Lynn was there filming Mary Poppins, or no, maybe it was finishing his Dark Materials. He filmed a few things in the UK. And so together, yeah, Lynn and Vanessa Miranda and the Duke and Duchess of Sussex hosted a gala, like a private performance of Hamilton, where every seat sold was for like the charity of the foundation, you know, the whatever it was for. And I guess that I think Meghan is a big fan of Hamilton because she's a Black American woman, so that would make sense. But Lynn made Harry sing part of You'll Be Back on stage, like at the gala.
Oh, that's
like,
great.
Oh, that is so like, precious.
He was, you know, when Lynn gave his speech and introduced Harry, and then Harry, like, kind of teased and he, like, sung a little bit of You'll Be Back, and then he was like, that's all I can do. He wanted me to do more and I'm not doing more. But, like, as in, like, literally he's the, like, I think the great-grandnephew of George III or something, because Victoria wasn't George's daughter. I don't know, the royal family history is...
God, that's, like, so recent. It's weird.
But it was not that reason. It was like...
No, a great-grandnephew, yeah. It just makes it weird.
No, maybe great-great-grandnephew.
Like, oh, okay. I was like, what? You know, how is that possible? Did I miss, like, 100 years in time or something?
A couple of generations, but okay. Yes. It is...
it's still surprisingly close, all of this, and how it still boils down to us being, like, yes.
And apparently Lynn... Because Lynn's about to go back to Puerto Rico and do Hamilton.
Oh, he's there. You have to look at the pictures of him arriving at the airport. They're so great.
Oh, I haven't.
Everyone is so happy he's there.
Oh, it's so beautiful. But he gave an interview because he's been training. Like, he's been doing videos of himself relearning the lyrics because he's going to play Hamilton again, which is just really, I'm so happy for him, but it's so stressful and sad and weird.
In his laundry room? Yeah, when he has to. Mm.
Well, not just that, but, like, they're doing it because it was original. He always wanted to do it, but now they're doing it because of the hurricane as well. So,
yeah.
Apparently, he was sitting next to them in the gala performance in London, and he was like, Meghan, like, the Duchess of Sussex knew the words better than I did, and so I'm a bit worried about, like, going back to Puerto Rico and stuff, so... Yeah, and it's just really, they've provided me a lot of joy this year, Harry and Meghan. They've really been the biggest positive, consistently positive force in my 2018. So
they're beautiful smiles. That's enough to sell me.
Oh, she's the most beautiful woman. She's just great, and he's so cute. But like, yeah, I don't know. That's been a real positive for me this year. But, I mean, that also, I suppose that ties a little bit into what my other one was, which is a more general statement, is that one of my other positives this year, my other biggest positive on a wider scale, because that's a very specific one, is celebrity activism in general. And I guess, like, what I was saying about the way the royals have changed their way of behaving, their way of, you know, using their voice does tie to that. But that's not just that this year. That's been going, you know, for quite a few years since Harry and William got their own press secretary separate to Charles and the rest of the royal family. So they actually, like, control their own voice to the extent that they can. I know
one thing that I've realized recently is that, like, I know a lot of royal knowledge that, like, is like, yeah, duh, like the same as the sky is blue, that a lot of people are like, how do you know that? And I'm like, I just know that. Everyone knows that, don't they? Like, and I'm like, no, apparently they don't. Apparently I'm like a royal, apparently I'm obsessed with the royal family to a degree that I thought was normal, but apparently it's not. That's fine. But their activism has become more personal and vocal. But so have a lot of celebrities, especially in the USA, like especially with the midterms. The start of the year with March for Our Lives and that as well. So there was that, and I think that over the Trump term, like I think that honestly, probably since the Women's March. And, you know, the election of 2016, that there has been a huge increase in people's using their voice to their followers. And, of course, that's been problematic in some ways, but ultimately I think it's, like, a real positive. Like, I think it's, like, and it really pisses me off when people are, like, oh, you're just an actor or whatever, you're a coastal elite, you don't, like, understand. And it's, like, a lot of these people came from other places, like they pursued the arts in Hollywood or New York, but they came from small towns, or they work with, you know, like crew. Like a lot of people talk about, like the crews, or like the, you know, the way that not their own lives are affected, but the people that are like more working class that are in help make the art that they make and stuff like that. And I think that everyone has been raising their voices to kind of use their platform in a way that is, I believe, a good thing. Like, and I really think that we're at a point where, like, politics is more based in human rights. Like, it's more based in, like, social, social beliefs. Like, do you actually believe in equality? Like, yes, no. And that people like, you know, Taylor Swift, like, the way that her speaking up politically for the first time, like, literally, like, the influence on the Tennessee midterms was, you know, unfortunately not successful, but the amount of votes counted, especially because you guys don't have compulsory voting. So I think in the USA, where there's no compulsory voting, the fact that people are being more vocal, it's kind of like there seems to have shift, as in like you know, like apathy in the face of injustice is complacent, you know. And I think that a lot of people who always might have thought it was more socially correct or more like beneficial to their fans, or like, you know, that they didn't want to alienate their fans by saying one thing or another, or that they wanted to, you know, they thought that it was more fair and more good to be neutral or to be publicly neutral, that line has been crossed now, that line has been like, okay, no, now it's not just like we're going to keep everything pleasant and be neutral. Now it matters more to actually do something, like that it's that point of crisis of neutrality is siding with oppression, if you know what I mean. And I've seen a lot of people get to that stage this year in a way that, you know, the circumstances that have made it happen are shit. Like the fact that we have to have that is shit. But the fact that people have actually stepped up and said that, you know, neutrality in the face of injustice is in a line with oppression is really hopeful to me. Jensen Ackles, again, is one of them. Misha Collins has always been very political, but Jensen Ackles has been he's very not very outgoing person, especially on social media. He's, like, quite restrained. And he is super progressive. Like, anyone who, like, knows him knows that, but he's not. He never publicly talked about like voting or anything like that. And this year he did, like him and Jared and Misha, they were like out for Better O'Rourke and for this MJ Hager, who made that, you guys saw that video of the, she was a Texas candidate for House of Representatives, that veteran. And she made that like amazing video that went viral.
Mm-hmm.
That she's one of the she's in one of the Austin districts. Like when they live in Austin, they were, when we're at a rally for her, they were like, even Jensen being like, go and vote. Like even that was like, it should be so basic, but it was something that he did restrain from before because he was so private. And like, he's kind of like
people are like pushing through that personal restraint because of how bad it is. And I think that that's a good thing in my opinion. And I think that's sort of in line with Harry and Meghan's choice and William and choices, you know, in the royal family to change their way of using their voice too. But that's a very different circumstance. The stuff that I saw with like American, you know, Hollywood celebrity kind of American entertainment industry because of the midterms has really impressed me, despite the fact that why it's necessary is so, so, so terrible.
You bring up a lot of good points, and I think the best of them all are that it's a positive thing that we can get into this escape, yes, of the British royalty, but we do still have a lot of people who did speak up. Yes, of course, Taylor Swift's going to touch my heart there, that never talked about it before, but now are here, and they're bringing in their voice to make sure that the oppression and human rights of it all are in the good or in the green. We want to forward human life. We don't want to end it. We want to make the world a better place, not make it a worse place. And if that means that we have to have celebrities tweeting political tweets where some are often saying their voice doesn't belong, I will absolutely take that, because that criticism falls flat of the influence that these influencers do have.
Mm. Yeah, Brittany, how do you feel about this? Because I know that some of your celebrity faves were kind of wearing you out with their activism.
Oh, I don't care about the activism if they're using it to support someone, that's fine. If they're getting into fights, I'm over it. So like don't go after another celebrity on Twitter because they're supporting a Republican, you're supporting a Democrat. Like I don't, or like, especially like when it was like in party fighting was when it was exhausting me. So it was like the primaries of between Hillary and Bernie.
Yeah. And like,
as we all know, that caused a huge problem than where we are right now. So
that's a whole other.
That was when it was exhausting, because it was like, yes, you're fighting for a different candidate, but you're also like infighting in a way.
And infighting weakens the strength, exactly. Which is obviously, we all know how that ended. So yeah, no, totally get that. Yeah. But this year, has anyone particularly impressed you in that department of like stepping up in a responsible way? Or
I feel like the people who I follow who have been more vocal have always been vocal.
Mm-hmm.
So no one, like, it feels like it's been a very gradual thing. Like everyone either started all at once and is at this, has reached the same level at the same time, whether it's for politics or for, you know, gun violence or like, you know, whatever it is. I feel like everyone's sort of hit it at the same time. So no one has really impressed me, because I feel like everyone did it at the same time and that one person is sticking out in my mind. If that makes sense. It was like such a wave of change, but everyone I kind of follow got on it at the same time. So I can't.
Yeah. Like everyone stood up at once. Yeah. I've seen a few notable ones that are like, and I'm not saying that to like throw shade on the fact that they didn't say anything before, but like, just the awareness that the circumstances have changed in terms of like what's the more responsible thing to do. Like they've recognized that it was once responsible to do A, it's now, the world has changed in such a dangerous way that it's now no longer responsible to do A and it's more responsible to do B. And so despite feeling uncomfortable or private, they're going ahead and doing B. And that's kind of really a big deal to me, that people kind of feel the fear and do it anyway, you know, especially in the public eye when people care what they think, or even to let their supporters know that they stand in a certain corner, like so that they can feel safe, like loving them, you know, like that, you know, you wouldn't want to know that like someone that you really loved, like secretly supported like people that wanted to kill you or something.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty heartbreaking. It's happened, unfortunately. Yeah. You do your best to move through it and say, okay, I just keep going to Thank You Next. It's the only thing I have for 2018, honestly. We're going to say thank you next to our hypes and gripes here.
Yeah.
Because we have some thoughts from our wonderful listeners coming in for our wrap-up podcast of 2018. I'll take the first string from This is the Queer Place at Nurse Brack, who wrote in, "My hype is Dungeons & Dragons. I fell hard for it this year. Made some great friends and had some amazing times. Watch Critical Role." Yeah, we were definitely just speaking about Dungeons & Dragons becoming big. Was this where you were thinking of it then, Natalie?
No, I think it's just universal. Like, I think it's just that prominent, to be honest. So, yeah.
Too funny. Yeah, no, it's going everywhere. And then they continue, "My gripe is that I'm getting older and starting to fall into all those behaviors I hated so much when I was young and being into fandom. I try to catch myself, but it's hard sometimes. I don't know if it's the baby fans who just don't get it or if I'm becoming a bitter old cow of fandom. I fear I may be the latter. One might almost call you a bitter clucking witch hen." It's a good thing. You want to be one of those.
I would love to know what kind of things that he's talking about, because I feel like the same in some ways, like get off my lawn about a few things, but I'm wondering what specific things that patterns he thinks he's falling into. So let me know if you want, even if you DM me. I'm curious. I'll take the next one. Mm-hmm. Mariah, not Carrie, Mariah Lovegood says, "My gripe," because I asked the listeners what their number one hype and gripe, like the way that we've just done that. "My gripe is not having enough time to see all the amazing movies I wanted to this year, from movies Crazy Rich Asians to Aquaman. Family stuff's made it tough year to find time for myself and especially time with my hubby. So my hype is extra special." So her hype is, "We made our first overseas trip to the UK and Ireland. Best part was seeing the Harry Potter studio tour in London. I was in the last room for almost an hour, cried when I left. # Hogwarts is my home." And I love this because I have kind of issues in terms of, like, there are many things about, like, everything about the way that Harry Potter's developed, from J.K. Rowling's behavior to also the fact that, like, the movies and the books are very different to me. But there is still that intrinsic attachment. And when I went to Warner Brothers studio tour, I haven't been to that, to the Orlando Hogwarts, when it first opened in the theme park, Universal Studios, we went there a few days because we had like a 4-day pass and it was at a leaky con. So we were like in and out of the park constantly, like basically like going in and out without limit. And the last day that we were there, it was fine. And then the last day we were in like the Honeydukes, the sweet shop, and Leo and I both just started crying. And the guy in there was really nice. Like, we weren't being like crazy or anything, but I was like, and the guy was like, "Oh yeah, do people cry a lot?" And he was like, "Yeah, after we first opened, like there would be people that would come through the gates into the Hogsmeade like part in the gates in Universal, like they'd enter from the rest of the park, and they would uncontrollably like fall to their knees and start crying." And I think that that's just really powerful. Like, I think it's just like, despite the fact that there's all this weird movie bullshit, and despite the fact that J.K. Rowling is just like doing some very strange things with her like life after Harry Potter, like the way that she's handled like the books post-release, I think that again, like, it's like what I said about that Supernatural fandom, like, you know, that the good outweighs the bad. And I think that for a lot of people, and in a lot of ways, like with Harry Potter, that the good will always like, there might be a lot of disappointments or like distance in certain things, like Fantastic Beasts or whatever it is, but there is still like this really deep, like, core part of your makeup that is that affected by it. And so I really love that.
Right, especially as I was relaying my story of learning to read for Harry Potter, I can only imagine how I'd feel there. Ugh, I can't wait. One day I'll go. All right, and then Brittany, our next tweet.
"I'm Leah. My ultimate hype is immersing myself more in fan culture. I used to just exist in the periphery, but since getting more involved, I've had much richer experiences. My gripe is more personal that reared its ugly head again during the holidays." So, sorry to hear that.
I think the first point is like very similar to, yeah, like I do agree with that, but it's also similar to your work walking to a story, you know, like the more engaged you are with an experience, mm-hmm. the deeper the experience is. And I definitely feel like that about fandom. Like it's very easy for me to like suspect my care about something to fade away if all I did was watch the show, if you know what I mean. Like, lots of things I still care about, but like there are lots of things that I love in the moment, but they fade away if all I did was read the book or watch the show or watch the movie. The things that strike a chord that I want to keep having conversations about, that's how fandom develops, like because the thing makes you want to keep having a conversation about it, and then you do, and then you talk about it forever, basically. So I still love that, you know, even though it's crazy.
And going into our next tweet, we have Andre at @hey_it_Andre, who wrote in, ultimate hype of the year has to be Infinity War. Ultimate gripe is probably Crimes of Grindelwald. I have to revisit Infinity War. It just got on Netflix probably like a couple days ago. I'm not sure. It was my poor Gamora. I knew it was coming. I felt it in my bones before the movie happened. I had no spoilers in me. And when it happened, I just didn't have any emotion left for it. So maybe I'll have it this time around.
I really have no idea where this movie's going to go. Like, I just, after the snap, like, I've got like a shape of an idea of how they might be able to fix it or what direction they might go, but I really don't know. Like, I feel very unprepared for Endgame, so that's interesting.
We're all going to feel it together, and we also always feel the crimes of Grindelwald. We'll continue to feel them.
Did you see that one, Brittany?
Yes, I did.
I have not seen it. Any redeeming factors?
No, I would just wait until it is released digitally and everyone gifts all the Jude Law scenes, and then you'll be caught up.
Okay.
Also, I do like Newt, and I'm kind of
Eddie Redmayne is
feel like they...
Beautiful boy.
They were just like, oh, right, we have to give him a storyline. Here's something ridiculous.
In the first movie, I really loved his... I loved how much... He loved the animals. Like, I loved how well that he acted out, how genuinely, like, moved he was by these animals that were, you know, obviously like tennis balls on sticks, you know, like, they're all CGI. Like, because Newt, like, he's meant to be this fucking mad scientist, like, you know, and, you know, animal lover to the point that he wrote those books. They really did well with like making that like very deeply felt with him in the movie. And I don't know, like, why would they just give him a stupid?
It's like
story.
It's,
like,
I get what they're trying to do with him, but at the same time, it's like, well, why did you make these movies called Fantastic Beasts and not just this is going to be Dumbledore versus Grindelwald?
So yeah, like, why was the entry point like? New, like, why is this some weird thing that J.K. Rowling always knew for 20 years and never told anyone?
It's not great, but I would probably never see it again.
Yeah, same. If anything,
for Ezra Miller, who deserves better, him and Eddie Redmayne both deserve better.
They always have. Yes. Well, Eddie Redmayne has had a lot of good. The costumes are worth it. If anything, I thought they were pretty fantastic. If anything was, but our last tweet is going to you, Brittany, from our friend Mai.
So Mai says, the hypest hype was getting to meet good friends in person for the first time. Also, the Caps winning the fucking Stanley Cup. Woo!
Okay, I will say that the Washington Capitals winning the Stanley Cup, I'll make that my hype by proxy of the year. Because I don't hockey, but I
understand. So many friends do.
But so many of my personal friends do, and B, I understand why the Caps winning is different. Like, I understand why it's not just a team winning. Like, I understand their culture is very different and they have this history of, like I understand enough by osmosis to understand that this is, like a, not just, like, an underdog win, but, like, more like a, like, little fan favorite kind of, like,
Like the Caps is like the hockey equivalent of like Lin-Manuel Miranda, like just this like good vibes situation who's breaking a lot of rules of like traditional like history and structure. And I understand why them winning was like such a big deal in more than just this is the team I support. Like I understand that what their fan culture represents is something very different. And so that can be my hype of the year by proxy, like the thing I'm happiest for other people. So yeah.
Well, I'm glad they all support the same team or appreciate the same team. Cause if not,
lots of people like different hockey teams, but I think that a lot of people were happy for the Cats because of the culture around them. So yeah.
Geez, we've covered absolutely every single ounce of culture literally that I can think of in this episode. We're gonna end
it. This is not a sport heavy show either, so
no, yeah. And to go into sports, I mean, it has to mean that my head are handed it, right? Mm-hmm. We're on to our question of the day for hashtag.
This is from Andre as well. Like, hey, it's Andre.
Oh, right, definitely. For Ask Not About the Weather podcast, anything.
This is not even question of the day. It's question of the year.
So, ooh, here we go. This is a big one. So be as narrow as broad as we all feel. I already have my list pre-made of two. He writes...
Two? He says one.
Well, I had to just... No. Okay. From one book, show, or movie that's been on your list forever that you didn't get to this year, but will definitely read/watch in 2019. I forgot the other one I listed, so I'm just going to say it was To All the Boys I've Ever Loved. That
to
one.
To All the Boys I've Loved Before.
I'm so tired. I know. I can't. My brain's not functioning at hour 4 of podcasting. Brittany, save me. What's yours?
Mm-hmm. Mine is Lord of the Rings, read or watch.
Oh, okay. So we're not just talking this year, we're talking in general. I got
it. In general, but I should do it in 2019, I think.
What about something that came out this year that you didn't get to?
Oh, it wasn't that specific. Okay. One thing that came out this year that I didn't get to?
I'm just curious. Like, that's just me adding my
own. Oh, okay. Okay, I wasn't prepared for that. Every single movie that's probably going to be nominated for an Oscar because I haven't seen a single one.
I can give you three, one like a book, show, and movie, all of which I'm like have every desperation in the world to see and focus on, but like have not got to or like missed in cinema. And movie, it is actually already been mentioned, Crazy Rich Asians. I missed it in cinema here because I was away and it hasn't come on any streaming services here yet. And I couldn't buy the DVD, I suppose, but I'm like, wanted to see it so badly and haven't seen it yet. Show that I still haven't seen that came out this year was Crime Story Versace. I still have not seen it. I couldn't handle it, and now I feel like I can handle it, but I haven't done it yet. And book actually came out the year before was La Belle Sauvage, which is the sequel to his dark, well, not sequel, the prequel to His Dark Materials, the new His Dark Material books. By Philip Pullman. I have not got to read that
yet. Sir Philip Pullman, he's a knight now. He was knighted.
Oh, sorry. Sir Philip Pullman.
He was knighted.
I have not got to that yet, and I feel very ashamed about that, but I'm going to have to get to that as soon as I can because, yeah, again, I just couldn't handle it. That actually came out late October 2017, so that's no good. But, yeah. But I will be doing all of those things in 2019, as well as, you know, Black Sails and probably Veronica Mars.
Oh. Ooh, what a twist at the end. I like it.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's what we're going to be getting into. Feel free to write in what you didn't get to in a book, show, or movie at our Twitter. And now we're going into our penultimate segment of this episode, Two Truths and a Lie, where myself, the lead host, will do two truths and one lie, and the other two hosts have to guess what the lie is. In advance, I prepared this one. Of course, it's Broadway related. I have seen the following shows either on Broadway or on the professional tour.
Mm-hmm.
First being The Lion King. Second being The Music Man. Third being Phantom of the Opera. What is the lie?
I'm going to go with Lion King.
Lion King is the life of Brittany.
I'm going to say Music Man, because if there was a national tour, I don't think the Music Man's been on Broadway and has done a national tour in a long time, but I think that you did the Music Man in high school, and I think that's why you know it.
I think you're right, Natalie. That's why I put it there. It was a trick question.
Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. I've never seen it. I performed in it.
I didn't even know that you've done it. I just think that your voice would suit the Music Man. So was I right?
Yes. No, yeah. I was in the quartet for the Music Man, which I think I
remember. Yes, that's exactly what I would have predicted.
Oh, that's so funny. No, it's probably because you're remembering it from like 5 years ago on Glee Chat, honestly.
I don't know if we've ever mentioned this, but I know that the Music Man hasn't done a national tour in a long time.
Right.
But I know that it's licensed for schools because my brother's school also did it.
Yeah, I did it at a community theater, but yeah.
And I know that your voice is right for that show. So,
well, thank you. I appreciate that. It was so much fun. It really was. But the other two, I did see The Lion King, my first Broadway show at Broadway. And both when I saw it on tour later on in life and the first time, it made me cry. The beginning is just like the elephants and the giraffes coming through the stage. And
I saw the professional international tour, like the Broadway, like the... when they licensed the tour to that professional level of those, you know, the puppets and stuff in Sydney. And I didn't love the whole show. Like, there was ups and downs compared to the movie, but the opening of The Circle of Life was...
It's worth the ticket. It's really worth the ticket.
Yeah, it was incredible.
Like, if it just ended right there, I think I'd be okay. Right.
Yeah, it was just, very incredible.
Phantom of the Opera is one of my favorite musicals. I think I often talk about it just in life. I often tweet about it, it seems. So, that one just has to be a given that I've already seen it, I figured. I didn't get to see Love Never Dies because it was coming on tour to Denver, and I decided to move across the country. So my tickets went to my good friends. They enjoyed it. It's probably best that I don't see it. It's a lackluster sequel, but I love the original. I saw it once again on tour. And I took a selfie next to the theater, actually right next to Anastasia when I was just there. So I need to tweet that too, I guess. I need to get up on my Twitter. But yeah, that's my two truths and a lie for this episode, the last of 2018. We're going to end our episode with Brittany's high conclusion for Not About the Weather. Go ahead, Britt.
2018 was long. If you love it, keep loving. If not, thank you next.
Much like this podcast, it was long. If you like it, keep going. Thank you, everybody, for listening to 4+ hours of Not About the Weather today. And
it has not been 4+.
It has. We're there.
Almost. We're there. Almost.
Aren't we? It was a good
like
time.
Like 3.5. It'll be 3.5.
I lost track. I really did.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. We had a fun time, and I'm happy we got to cover all of 2018 in that span of time. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. And for now, we're going to sign off for 2018, but thank you for tuning in, and we hope to see you in the next year. Until then, I've been Mitch.
Oh, I guess I'm Nat.
Bye, everybody.